ever go fishing? Or did I prize? I ever watched a great fighter?
I don't know.
I'm trying to tell you how you sing.
Do you mean like a prize fighter or a fish?
Yours, Mine, and Theirs. Hey everybody, this is Roy Fillmore, co-host of Yours, Mine, and Theirs, the fourth greatest movie podcast, where you help us pick a weird subgenre and we watch three movies, Democracy and Judy Garland. That's what this is all about. Like I said, I'm Roy, and good morning, John. I'm just wild about this podcast, but we can't do it alone. We got to have Richard go with us, even though he was born in a trunk in Swanee. My awards aren't great, but I'll get by because I did it by myself. I could go on singing, but I think it's time to lose that long face and get on with the show.
All right. Well, good sum up of everything, Roy. Hey, everybody. I'm John Madsen, and I could go on podcasting till the cows come home, or at least until my co-hosts say, enough already.
With us today, our special guest, Richard. Introduce yourself.
Well, you can get me here to the podcast studio. Of course you could get me in the door, but I decide if I podcast. Not you, not Roy, not JR, not John, not any of your aliases. It's me. Me, I decide when I podcast. And I'll podcast today. I decided.
Well, that's news to us, Richard. Thank you for
that was excellent.
Coming in hot. Thank you so much for being here, man.
So, yeah, our guest is Richard Templeman, and welcome, Richard. We're really happy to have you on, and we're connected to Richard through our old Star Trek podcast, which I say old, but it's still kind of going, and Richard's been listening to that for a while. And, I mean, I don't know when you started. We've been doing Star Trek for 13 or 14 years, but, so we've connected with Richard that way. And so this is Richard's first time on, which means he gets to bring three movies that are important to him. And in 2 weeks, he has to do community service, which I think he's not going to complain about. It feels like a good category for Richard.
Absolutely.
We will get to that. So, Richard, introduce yourself. Tell us about your 20 podcasts and all that good stuff.
I could go on bragging till the cows come home. So, yeah, I copied the JR Watches Star Trek podcast format, but kind of have a new spin on it called Turning Trekkie. I do a Watch Your TV Show podcast. I do a radio show podcast, a Broadway podcast. One could say I enjoy podcasting.
Okay, just so you know, I've listened to the Star Trek podcast and I've listened to a little bit of the TV podcast, but I haven't had a chance. I should tell my intern to listen to some of the other podcasts. I haven't had a chance to listen to the other ones. But what's the radio podcast?
That one's a good one. I've listened to one of those.
Yeah, the second golden age of radio is we take an old-time radio show, like we could listen to Babes in Arms, the radio show, or A Star is Born, the radio show. We'll talk about it, the history of the radio show. And then we do our own version called a New Time Radio Show. So we're basically doing like a modern day retelling of the show in podcast form. Yeah.
So wait, do you rewrite it for modern times?
Yeah, we used to like kind of script it out, but now we just talk about it and we improvise a brand new radio show.
Oh, wow.
Oh.
And so it's cool because Richard doesn't have like one person that he has somehow forced to do all these five podcasts with. He's got a different co-host for each one, just about, right?
Right.
So a vast podcasting network.
Wow.
That okay. Anchor is paying him millions of dollars to yes. produce.
Dozens of dollars a year is what you were saying, which is great. I always assumed the whole podcasting venture was a venture where you could count on losing dozens of dollars a year rather than gaining dozens of dollars a year. Because usually it takes dozens.
What's our profit so far? I think it's just in the cost of microphones, right? So I think
it's negative 300. Considering the cost of our upcoming live event as of this recording, I would say about $1,500 in the hole.
We're $1,500 in the hole, yeah.
Whoa.
So that's over the course of several years. That's all the microphones you've broken and also our live event and also bribery to have people on. So Yeah, so I guess it slowly adds up. It's, you know, the whole system is nickel and diming us. Okay, Richard, tell us about the other podcast that I didn't hear about.
I do The Broadway Baby and The Musical Maniac, where we watch a Broadway show and we talk about it. Basically, all my formats are pretty much the same. It's like if I have an interest or hobby in something, I'll podcast about it.
Yeah.
So the Broadway one, I started to listen to the In the Heights podcast, but I decided to stop because I didn't know if we'd be watching that soon. Plus, I haven't seen it before, and so I didn't want it to get spoiled for me. But that seems like a really interesting podcast, and it's similar, right? To because you have someone on who is watching those Broadway shows for the first time, right?
Yeah, someone who's less experienced in the Broadway world, just getting a baptism by fire.
The baby.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Baby's going to come up again in this podcast.
Okay, baby? Yeah.
A couple times, yeah.
Oh, so, like, we would be, like, good candidates for such a thing.
Yes, you would. Okay, yeah, come aboard.
I'm not even going to ask you for your cred, Richard, because I think it's way up there. But let's see, John, Broadway shows. Okay, so... of course, I've done Phantom of the Opera because I think everyone has. So
you're talking Broadway.
Are we talking has to have been on in New York? If it has to be in New York, then still Phantom, The Lion King, Mary Poppins, Wicked. Is that everything I've seen on Broadway in New York? I think so. That may be it for real Broadway.
Okay. Let me try to remember. I saw... Threepenny Opera, and I saw Wicked, and I saw Jersey Boys, I think, and trying to remember if I've seen anything else. But, and then the first Broadway – okay, no one else can claim this, but the first Broadway play I ever went to, I also performed in.
Oh.
And I don't know how many other people can say that. It's the 25th annual Putnam County Spelling Bee.
Oh, that makes sense.
Yeah. And it was the first Broadway show I ever went to, and they called me out of the audience to spell words.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I also understand that if you go to Cats, that you can stand up and just declare yourself to be a kind of cat and climb up on the stage.
And then you're a part of the show. That's what I've heard, too.
You're permanently a part of the show, right? That's how you get it.
Was that in Kimmy Schmidt?
That was in Kimmy Schmidt.
Cats?
Yeah, he cons them out of the show, and then he realizes that's how everyone got in. So.
Yeah, okay. But I don't know. I'm not the most Broadway-type person. You were talking about In the Heights a few minutes ago, and I think In the Heights came out, like, last summer, right? And that was, like, really deep into quarantine.
Yeah.
And everyone was talking about how, like, joyful it is because, you know, it's like, oh, it's so great to see people out in the streets singing and dancing. And I watched the first 5 minutes, and I just couldn't handle it. I'm like, I can't handle people in the streets singing and dancing. I can't do it.
What about West Side Story? That's people in the streets singing.
Yeah.
Les Miserables, people in the street singing.
I was eased into those.
Newsies.
I was eased into those. Newsies, I never saw the movie, but I saw the high school play, and but it was pretty good.
So is it the sesquicentennial of Blaine that was being produced in Waiting for Guffman? I don't know if that ever made it to a Broadway stage or not.
I don't believe it did.
With Corky St. Clair producing
that would be good.
Okay. Have you ever seen Waiting for Guffman, Richard?
Yeah. Yeah, I like it. I like all those improvised / loosely scripted videos. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So now, Richard, were you like in the like drama club all growing up, or was it just like, so it's just like in your blood? It's not something you switched on.
Yeah, I think I was drawn to it. I think Judy Garland got me into theater because she's so theatrical. And I was just a child renting videos from Blockbuster and checking her movies out from the library. And, I got to scratch that itch to perform. So junior high, when they offered drama and drama club, I joined. So I feel like it's always been there.
Well, good transition because, I mean, we thought it was like when 2 weeks ago when you said, okay, you know what? These are the three movies that, you know, that made me, and then the three Judy Garland movies, and you said you grew up with them. Were you like inexplicably drawn to Judy Garland? Is there something – because I always thought that was just like a stereotype, like theater kind of stereotype and, you know, et cetera.
Yeah, it's one of those things where it's like – is it okay that it's a stereotype if it's true? Like, yeah. For me, that was my gateway drug into, like, the whole gay world of theater, of performing, was Judy Garland and listening to her on my Walkman and, like, singing to my friends at school. And they're like, yeah, you're special, Richard. I'm like, but why? Why am I special?
But no one told you about Judy Garland, right?
No, nobody told me. I think my favorite movie growing up was Wizard of Oz, so that really got me into it. And then I just became obsessed, like reading her biographies that people have written and watching the made-for-TV movies that they made about her. Yeah, but...
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
So if we can talk a little bit about Judy. Not Judy, but Frances Ethel Gum.
Absolutely.
Right. So her father was gay. Mm-hmm. Right. And then I believe she later was married to a gay man as well.
I think Vincent Minnelli was rumored to be gay.
Okay.
And maybe her first husband, that marriage only lasted like a couple of months. I think she just like Liza, they're kind of drawn to the gays, but they didn't know that their lovers were gay. Yeah.
I didn't know Vincent Minnelli was rumored. I don't want to label Vincent Minnelli. He's not on the podcast unless, you know, unless our intern got him on, but also I'm sure he's dead.
So,
but yeah. I mean, it's kind of weird that it seems like Liza Minnelli, like everyone made fun. I don't know. It was in the news, like when Liza Minnelli got married, I remember this, and everyone was like, oh, you kind of married a gay guy. That's what everyone was saying. And I didn't realize that everyone was just kind of parroting what they probably did with her mom. It was just kind of like expected. And so that's why the conversation was like that.
Yeah. I think that maybe something inside them was drawn to homosexual behavior or people. And, it, you know, they didn't realize, though, because you weren't supposed to be out back then. So,
yeah. So my daughter's gay, and I had a conversation with her about Judy Garland, and I said, do the lesbians even care about Judy Garland? She said, well, not as much. And now, granted, like, her career as a lesbian is pretty short, but so she was familiar with the phrase, are you a friend of Dorothy? And she's used it before to try to discover if a coworker was gay, and that coworker did understand what she was talking about. And finally she said, are you a lesbian or not? But yeah, so that's a phrase, right? Like, are you a friend of Dorothy? And my understanding is, I guess, because like Dorothy had the in Wizard of Oz, like the three friends that she had with her, they were a queer bunch of friends, right? And so that's also where the term queer comes from. And so that's fascinating. So there's all that.
Oh,
yeah,
what? Really?
Absolutely.
That's what she says, a queer bunch? I don't remember.
Well,
that
she never says it in the movie, but this is just, well, I think I just Googled why is Judy Garland a gay icon? And so I started reading all the really authoritative stuff. By Garland. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Okay, here's a dumb question.
Yeah.
Is the rainbow symbol, does it have to do with, like, associating that with Judy Garland singing a song about rainbows?
I can't imagine it not having something to do with that. I did not do the research on the rainbow icon, but just the fact that friend of Dorothy was a popular term after, you know, around World War II, and people were kind of secretive about their homosexuality, so that it became friend of Dorothy. And yeah, between the Wizard of Oz and Dorothy Parker, people like associate them as being friends of the gays. And so a friend of Dorothy means you're gay. Yeah, I would assume that because of the Wizard of Oz being a pretty popular movie, not when it came out in 1939, but in the 50s when they started airing it every year for Christmas.
Yeah.
And so that kind of became a staple in at least the United States, that every time around Christmas in the December month that they would air that film, and then it drew in lots and loads of people watching it, audience and gay audience alike. So, yeah.
So I think there's the whole story too, right? Because she lives in this kind of drab life where she's not understood and it's confining, and she finds herself in this beautiful, vivid, colorful world where anything can happen, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right. But she decides to keep it to herself. She's like, oh, I guess I'll go back to my dirt farm and my terrible family and the neighbor who hates me in the black and white world. Okay, here's a really dumb question. This is kind of changing the topic. We're not talking about
The Wizard of Oz.
We're not talking about that movie. But Like, how could it have not have been a popular movie when it came out? Like, how was it not the Avatar of its time?
So it kind of was. I know we're not talking Wizard of Oz, and we really need to on some podcasts, but the Wizard of Oz, until E.T., was the most watched movie of all time. And E.T. eclipsed it, and then Titanic has since taken
But isn't it, like, most watched? I mean, Richard, you were just talking about, like, it wasn't necessarily popular until, like, the 50s.
Right.
Oh, I think it was still a popular movie for its time.
Yes. It was popular in 1939, but so many films came out that year. Yeah. The Women, Gone with the Wind, and they all kind of eclipsed The Wizard of Oz in popularity. Not to mention Babes in Arms came out that very same year in 1939, and it was a box office mega hit. That's the one that made all the money for the studio, and not as much The Wizard of Oz. So it wasn't until later that it was recognized as being as good as it was. It was just hard because it was successful. It just wasn't as successful as the other films.
So it cost $2.7 million in 1939 money to make The Wizard of Oz, which is pretty crazy.
It just seems like even so, Babes in Arms would be, you know, kind of the scrappy little independent.
It's the Paranormal Activity of Judy Garland movies. I don't know. Right.
It's so black and white.
If you guys can correct me if I'm wrong, but I fear we're never going to do The Wizard of Oz. I want to believe at some point we will. We'll probably watch it at the same time we watch Lord of the Rings or something. But the scene where she goes from black and white in her house to the color in the Land of Oz, right? So I don't know anything about film, but I've always wondered, okay, with their technology, how did they do that? So what I have read is that whole thing was filmed in color, but her clothes and the walls of her room were painted sepia tones. But if that's how they did it, I mean, they brilliantly matched the color of the film, right?
So all those old Charlie Chaplin movies, all the backgrounds are just painted black and white. Yeah, I have that's no idea. Right. Wow.
Anyway, we're not even doing The Wizard of Oz, which is fine because everyone's seen The Wizard of Oz. So Richard has treated me to three movies I've never seen before.
Yeah.
We are watching Babes in Arms, which Richard mentioned again came out the same year as The Wizard of Oz, and then A Star is Born, which I've seen the Barbra Streisand version, so this is the first time I've seen this version.
Oh, speaking of Barbra Streisand, I asked my gay brother if he has any, association or adoration for Judy Garland, and he said he's more of a Babs person.
That's fair.
Yeah.
They have that whole duet together when she's like, forget your troubles, happy days, come on, get happy. So they're akin to the same amount of gay iconicness. Yes.
So Get Happy is the name of the biography that I'm in the middle of reading.
Awesome. Yeah.
Super awesome. And then the last movie is I Could Go On Singing. So I think Richard mentioned this is the beginning and midpoint and end of her career, which tragically is a very short career. So she dies at the age of 47. And so this is weird because in Babes in Arms, she's what? How old is she then? 15?
Yep.
Okay. And then so in...
Wasn't she 17? Wasn't 17, 19?
I think they filmed it. Yeah, she probably had turned 16.
She was born in 22. So, I think that makes sense. If she was born in 22 and the movie was released in 39, then 17, I guess, right? So, but anyway, in A Star is Born, is she 32 years old or 34? I think she's 32.
Yeah, I think 31 to 32.
She doesn't look 31 to 32. And I don't want to be that guy that's like, wow, you know, that Hollywood actress is not aging well. But it's not horribly noticeable. But then when we get to I Could Go On Singing, she's 42 years old, but she looks like she's lived.
Yeah. I always said that growing up. I'm like, wow, Judy Garland looked like she went from being a child to being a 60, 70 year old woman, but in the span of only 47 years. So,
yeah.
She didn't treat her liver very well, and it's not all her fault, as you know from the book, but it takes its toll.
Yeah. So I want to get a little bit into that, and I can just seg it straight into Babes in Arms if you guys are ready to start talking these movies.
100%.
Okay. Yeah, let's talk the movies.
Okay, so I already mentioned, right, her name is Frances Ethel Gumm. Right. Her dad is Frank and her mom is Ethel. And their last name, unfortunately, is Gum. And so the movie Babes in Arms is a little biographical because her parents were like kind of did these vaudeville performances, but her, and they started in Grand Rapids. Is Grand Rapids, Michigan? It's Michigan, mm-hmm. right? Okay.
Right.
But they got kicked out of town because her dad was a little too gay, if you know what I mean. So they got kicked out of town and they ended up in California. Is it Lancaster?
I believe so.
Yeah, kind of actually where my wife's parents live, up in that area. They live in Santa Clarita. I think Lancaster is about a half an hour away. And so he opened up another theater there and they were doing the same thing. But I think at the age of like two, she joined her two sisters, and they were the Gum sisters, and she just had some serious pipes. And so her mom on the weekends would drive her down to Hollywood and audition her around, and or her and her sisters. But her sisters stopped getting asked to perform, and it was just her, because her sisters were kind of average, but Judy's voice, even at a very young age, was extraordinary. Unfortunately, as Richard alluded to, there were some substance issues that kind of came from her mom. So, she wanted her girls to be able to just keep performing and without rest. And so, back then, amphetamines were just for fun. They were just fun, to help keep the kids awake. But then because they were so, hopped up on,
they were on pretty speed. Much like Hermione's time turners.
Yeah.
Right.
So
like, these are just tools to like take several subjects and do several jobs and have several dances in a day.
But because they were so loaded on speed, they couldn't sleep. So their mom also gave them sleeping pills. So at the age of six, she's taking speed and sleeping pills. And then by the time she hits 12 or 13, by this time, she's been signed on to MGM. And she has girls of that age, they kind of hold on to some chub, right? And that's not what MGM wanted, so they also loaded her up with some diet pills. So she's taking three crazy drugs by the age of 13, and said that doesn't really help her moving forward. Anyway, she finishes filming The Wizard of Oz, and I guess there's a lot of post-production for The Wizard of Oz. So in the meantime, she films Babes in Arms. So this is interesting, too, because in Babes in Arms, there's that character. What's her name? It's Baby Rosalie.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, but so Judy Garland was kind of known as Baby Gum, right? That was her stage name, Baby. Like, she was always referred to as Baby, and she didn't really like it. And so the gum got dropped when she was on tour, and there was a guy on the tour with him, and his name was Garland, and so she took that. And then later, I think she herself chose Judy instead of Frances. Maybe I'm wrong about that, but I thought I was listening today, and that she said, I'm not doing this baby's crap anymore. I'm Judy. So anyway, Judy Garland sounds way better than Baby Gum. So, so good choice. So
I like Gum Baby.
Gum Baby.
Yeah, just anyway, Gum Baby.
This is like the 300th movie at this point that she's done with Mickey Rooney. And they all kind of have similar plots in that she likes Mickey and he finds himself entangled with another girl. And in the end, like, he comes around, right? And real, and there she is. But so in this one, what's going on is it Mickey's parents that are the vaudeville actors? I think it is, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they're determined to remain solvent and they're going to put on a new show and make money. But guess what? No one cares about vaudeville because talkies are all the rage. Well, Mickey Rooney and like a gang of misfit singing and dancing kids are determined to show their parents that vaudeville is not it anymore, but that they can continue to make money if they adapt to a new style. So they gather all these adults around and they get around the piano and they're like, oh, right, mom and dad, we're going to blow you away. This is like heavy metal, except this isn't the 80s. This is like the 1910s. And so get ready, hold on to your seats. And then they bring on some lady and some guy and they sing some opera. And it's just wild. So
Mickey Rooney plays piano like kind of like what's Jerry Lee Lewis? You know, he's doing the standing thing.
Well, that's what I was like waiting for, right? Like, oh, yeah. Okay, he's gonna like play Great Balls of Fire, but no, it's like an opera song, which reminded me of how rowdy that crowd got in the Red Shoes during that opera.
Yes,
yeah,
Red Shoes. Hey, Richard, you ever see the movie Red Shoes?
No, but I ought to.
You ought to.
We talked about it, and Roy and his Philistine brother hated it.
I didn't say I hated it.
It was beautiful. You implied it.
I love the motorboating. So
it's a good movie. Check
good
it out.
Movie. Yeah,
I
sure.
I will.
There is an extended song and dance fantasy scene in Red Shoes that's something else.
It's breathtaking.
It's breathtaking. Yep. Let's see. So they've decided to put on, I guess, a play, right? And they do it in someone's, it looks like someone's backyard, like kind of an outdoor amphitheater.
And yeah, they maybe put a farm or something.
A farm. They put these numbers together, and it's kind of a bunch of ragtag kids who first, like, do a giant bonfire in the middle of the street as they're getting psyched up. They run down the street with their torches. We're babes in arms, and we love singing and dancing, and we're going to do that with torches. And it kind of reminded
me. They were saying, like, you will not replace us or something like that. It's really weird.
It reminded me of the Halloween scene in Meet Me in St. Louis.
Meet Me in St. Louis, yeah.
Which was the freakiest Halloween scene from any movie I've ever seen in my
life. What is up with – I grew up in the 20th century, but what is up with 20th century children in torches and bonfires in Berlin movies?
I don't know. So – when things are looking like it's going to be kind of an average production, man, they get a ringer. They get baby Rosalie Essex. And I think she's supposed to kind of be your Shirley Temple, right?
That's what I thought, yeah.
Yeah. So she lives in a really fancy mansion where even little kids can smoke cigars. She decides to join the group, and she shows up one day, and her tryout, does she even need to try out? She just does like back handsprings for a full half hour. Like, they based the slinky off of her.
That wasn't her tryout. That was her just getting the kinks out. That was her warming up.
It was something else. Anyway, yeah, I think there...
Oh, I will have a lot to say about it later.
Yeah. I think there's a kissing scene, or like, no, there's another actor that's supposed to be working with Baby, but Mickey is... He shows everyone how to play their parts right. He's like, no, you got to do this like Clark Gable. No, you got to do this like this and this and this. And so I think he stands in for the kissing scene. And oh, boy, does... Judy Garland's character is Patsy, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Patsy leaves because she's upset. Anyway, she comes back, and they make up just in time for the big performance. And the performance we've been waiting all this time for is about 20 straight minutes of blackface performances. And then because God hates racism, he thunderstormed the whole thing out. But they are not to be... completely dampened of spirit, and they take their show to Broadway, where it gets picked up and produced. And their father, who's been poo-pooing Mickey Rooney this whole time, he gets called by the great producer on Broadway and says, hey, we've got a show, and it's your kid, come see it. And it's successful. And so there you go. I think that's it.
I guess they had a few notes concerning the long blackface segment.
The zero relent blackface segment.
Yeah. It just, because it kept going. But I think they're like, you know what? People like America. So the last, like, big medley is a big, flag waving, hurrah.
Yeah.
But it's so weird because both of those musical numbers, I don't know how much this matters, because I don't know how much, like, subject matter matters when you're putting on a show. But I just thought it was very surprising that they didn't put on a show about putting on a show.
Yeah.
Instead, it's like, okay, no, we're going to be doing this big minstrel show, and then we're going to be doing this big United States show. And it seemed like those themes just weren't explored beforehand. Not that that's like a huge issue or anything. I was just kind of surprised, like, oh, this is what their big show is about, because they didn't mention it.
Yeah. Anyway, because they're successful, they're able to kind of save their parents who've lost all their money and were going to have to pack up and leave. But not anymore. Now they can create conservatorships with their children and milk them for all they're worth.
So. Yeah. And
that's Babes in Arms.
Babes in Arms.
Babes in Arms. It differs a lot from the 1937 Broadway musical version of the show. Mm-hmm. By the time they filmed it in 1939, they cut out all of, like, the Rodgers and Hart songs except for, like, the Babes in Arms theme and another song. Yeah. So I thought that was odd, an odd choice when you have, Rodgers and Hart.
Yeah.
Now, no one's seen the 1937 version, right? Do you have any familiarity with even what that music is?
Yeah, because they did revive it on Broadway. They did change some of the plot, but they brought back all of the original songs. And some of the songs you will recognize, like My Funny Valentine, The Lady is a Tramp.
Oh, yeah.
I Wish I Were in Love Again. These are all songs that became popular because of the Broadway show. And they're barely in the movie or not in the movie at all. Like, you can hear, that's why The Lady is a Tramp in the background of Baby's Rosalie's scenes. But they're just background songs. But yeah.
I guess, were they just like, okay, everyone's going to go see this movie. It's a huge smash, and everyone's been hearing all the buzz about the play. So we may as well pack it with additional songs to just kind of sweep the media landscape with more content.
I think that's exactly what happened. And they did add Good Morning, which I think that was a good choice because Arthur Freed and Nacio Herb Brown wrote that song. And that became popular because of this movie and then later in Singing in the Rain.
Did they get paid more than $100 for that song?
I don't know. That scene is really funny, though. I think it's funnier in the radio show than in the film, but it's a funny scene where he just faints at the idea of being paid $100.
Well, he asks for $1,000, right? And then, like, oh, sorry, stupid kid, only $100 for you, which is $2,000 today. That's the currency conversion there.
It's a lot of money.
It's a lot of money. So he was basically asking for $20,000 for that song, and he got $2,000.
That's a very Mickey thing to do, I feel. Just, like, really overdo it.
Now, Mickey Rooney has passed away, right? Because it seems like every time I think he's dead, I see him in a new movie. But he's...
I think he finally died in 2008, maybe.
Okay.
Oh, wow.
He lasted a lot longer than Judy Garland.
Yeah, he did. Well, I think the last thing I remember seeing him in was Night at the Museum.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
He's like one of the old man security guards along with Dick Van Dyke.
Are you guys Mickey Rooney fans?
Well, so as far as young Mickey Rooney, this is the only young Mickey Rooney I've ever seen. Yeah. I will say I love the Black Stallion.
You can't deny how impressive he is in this movie.
He is very energetic.
And he won the Oscar, right?
For this movie?
I think he did win an Oscar.
Yeah. And so I think...
Yeah, he did. He was the youngest, or at least was nominated, the youngest nominee for an Oscar for Babes in Arms.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. When Mickey Rooney saves the day, when he saves Milhouse's day, when Milhouse was dressed up as Fallout Boy, and they helicopter in Mickey Rooney to, like, talk to Milhouse. And Mickey Rooney says, I was the highest Hollywood draw from 1939 to 1940. And Bart says, wow, spanning two decades. And so I always think of that because I've always been annoyed at Mickey Rooney because I feel like he's just this ball of old man and everything I've seen.
Oh, yeah.
It's just this kind of roly ball. And he's just like, I'm like, where does this confidence come from? And I'm seeing Babes in Arms and I'm like, oh, this is where all the confidence comes from.
Right.
Because I think he's really, really amazing. But I never took to old man Mickey Rooney. I'm always like, what's the deal with this old man?
And he's so short because if Judy Garland was 4'8" or 4'9" and he is not as tall as her, I'm like, you are short. You are a short gentleman.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I need to correct myself. He died in 2014.
Yeah.
April 6, 2014. So he lasted a lot longer than I even remembered.
Wow. No, that's I assumed he died in 1987 or something. Like, I'm like, wasn't Pete's Dragon his last movie? I just
Pete's Dragon.
Okay.
Have you watched that recently? Pete's the Pete's Dragon musical. It's almost unwatchable, and I want to love it because I like the music from it, but that movie is so hard to watch.
True, the music is good though.
Yeah.
All right, put that on the list. We gotta watch that.
I have a serious gripe with the fact that Pete takes his dragon into town and says, now be invisible because no one can know I have a dragon. And then the whole time that everything's happening in town, he's like, it's just my invisible dragon. And he's like, oh, you crummy Pete.
What?
You can't have it both ways, buddy.
No, you can't have it both ways. I feel like that was a budgetary necessity and not a plot-driven necessity.
Pete's not easy to love.
No, he's not.
Yeah. Anyway, it was great. I liked it.
It was great. Unfortunately, I did forget of the extensive blackface scene, so I apologize. But, you know, we have to come face to face with our history and acknowledge that it was not appropriate.
Right, so right.
Did you all watch the same version I did where it has the Mankiewicz introduction on TCM?
No.
Oh, okay.
I didn't get the introduction.
Yeah, so he does like the get ready for some blackface, but that's how they did it back then, and we're not gonna delete it. So there you go. So yeah.
I how many musicals have that?
Have blackface?
Yeah.
Well, so Holiday Inn.
I was gonna say Holiday Inn. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because it seems like we've come across it a lot. I'm like, oh, this is much more widespread.
Yeah.
Than I thought it was.
Because I always feel like, because I like Holiday Inn, but then like White Christmas is like Holiday Inn, except I don't have to sit through blackface with my kids.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm kind of thinking, you know, it's almost like, I mean, I'm the worst person to talk about this. I don't want to talk about, I'm very
so
bad
racist.
About political. I'm going to say something. Yeah, really. But I mean, it almost feels to me like all of these movies that have the blackface in it, it's almost like, first of all, it's a code for racism. Sure. You know, let's get that. But it's also a code for, hey, this is something you haven't seen. This is something unusual. This is something it's not, you know, your parents' kind of music. And so like I think that's the intent of it. It's like, okay, this is something, you know, apart from us. It's like the appropriation. But you know, we didn't realize appropriation was bad back then. So it's like appropriating to do something different. And that was like the appeal of it. It was like just making a major difference. But I don't know what they were thinking, but right. That's kind of what I'm thinking they're thinking.
Yeah. From what the research I did, that this minstrel show format with blackface was intended as comic entertainment, and it was performed by white musicians, and it was most popular from 1850 to 1870. But the reason why it's endured even later was due to vaudeville. So they did it back in the day, but then when vaudeville became the popularity, like it, going on tour doing these vaudeville shows, it came back, and then because of that it moved on to radio, TV, and motion pictures. So that's why we know about blackface and the minstrel show, because otherwise from 1850 to 1870 we wouldn't have really known that was a thing. But it came back, and yeah, it's inappropriate. Even people in the 1840s were already saying, like Frederick Douglass, he's like, yeah, those white performers that are doing blackface, they're kind of the scum of white society. So I think it's funny that there's always someone looking at what people are doing and going, this is not going to go well for you. This is not going to, this is not a good look for you. But they even knew back in the 1800s. But I guess in a way, for educational purposes, it's good to know that it's wrong and people did it. And now we can move on and evolve and not do it again.
Yeah. Right. Right. And I mean, that's interesting. Because we can't really excuse it for them. And when we say it was like a different time back then, it wasn't necessarily a different time where everyone was racist and everyone was like, yeah, okay, let's see if we can get away with this, and let's how funny it is that we're getting away with this racist thing. But there was like a different culture of not making a big deal out of people getting offended at stuff. Like we don't care what Frederick Douglass says.
So,
you know, like that's kind of the difference of – yeah.
So I always feel gross when I say it was a different time back then, because I think that like the people who were getting offended by it, just no one cared that they were getting offended, and they didn't really have a voice, right? So this wasn't appropriate in the 1930s, but I mean, no one cared what black society thought about Hollywood movies. So, I mean, you didn't hear about it, and there were no objections raised, right? So I don't know.
Yeah. I was surprised. I was surprised about the scene. It took me by surprise. Well, but also, hey, Babes in Arms, it was a fun movie. Yeah.
So I wasn't surprised by the scene because I knew it was coming. I was surprised that it lasted really. Yeah. Like it just
I didn't have the Mankiewicz introduction. It was so surprising.
Yeah.
Yeah. My version was the Turner Classic Movie version, but they had cut out the introduction. So that's what I got. But also it was interesting that they had originally cut out the ending of the film. So when they're on Broadway singing about being in the White House and the Oval Office and FDR and whatnot, after the president passed away, they're like, oh, let's not make fun of departed president. So they cut that out, and it was restored later.
And that's so weird, because that seems like something really sensitive to, like, they didn't make fun of the president. I don't understand.
Right.
What was that even? Like, why? Yeah. Okay. That's strange.
I think in their way, they were poking fun at the president and the first lady. But to us, we're like, that's so tame. That's so minor.
Right. I mean, by making fun, it's like we even acknowledging he was in a wheelchair. Was that making fun of the president? Just like, yeah.
Probably, because I know they were trying to hide stuff like that for a long time, the ableism, you know.
Funny. Okay. All right. This a different time, colon, the podcast. That's what we're talking about.
A different time. But some of the songs are great that they have in this adaption, like I said, with the one that was worth $100, which is $2,000 today.
Yeah.
Good morning, good morning. Love that.
Yeah.
I missed some of the old ones, but obviously you can listen to them on record.
I'm just wild about Harry.
I'm just wild about Harry.
Which
yeah.
I always thought that originated from that the Looney Tunes with the frog.
Right.
You know what cartoon I'm talking about, John? The frog that only sings and dances when that one guy's watching, and when he tries to make money off of it, it won't do anything. Well, it always
Hello, sings. My darling?
Oh my gosh, you're right. It's Hello, My Darling.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay, well then.
Similar.
I'm just okay. I'm done.
No, you're fine.
Yeah. I really liked Baby Rosalie.
Now you wanted to talk about that, and I think it should be brought up. Was she a contortionist? My goodness.
Yeah. Okay.
She was from the circus or something.
This is okay. No, it's. I'd never seen that before. I was freaked out. I was like,
is that a skill that's useful in movies?
Because you said she does a bunch of back handsprings. This is how I saw it. She folded herself backward, grabbed her ankles, turned her body into a wheel, and rolled around the stage. Like, that's a thing I witnessed on celluloid. Yeah.
She could bend herself backwards and touch her feet, like you're saying, and yeah, roll around or like flop herself upside down onto the stage like a fish.
Like, yes. She was moving like a weird wheel fish.
It was astonishing.
There's something about that where I feel like there's a real threat there, because, you know, she's the whole, like, okay, she has money and she has fame. And, you know, she is threatening to Judy Garland's character, and she's also extremely nice. And so it's not so much like, it's not like one of those, when we watch She's All That and like a Taylor Vaughn situation where it's just like the worst person in the world is the person who's like competing for, you know, She's All That person. It's like she has all these things. So it really, I think it really is a boon to the movie that the threat to Judy Garland is a triple threat. She can do all of that stuff. She just can't sing like Judy Garland. That's it. Yeah.
Well, and interestingly enough, there's kind of a parallel here, because originally MGM wanted, what's her head? Shirley Temple to play Dorothy Gale, but Shirley Temple can't sing, right?
Yeah. She might sell a lot of box office tickets, but you sing circles around her, Judy.
Yeah.
Which is true. And the funny thing is, like, Frances Ethel Gumm, so Judy Garland, is actually a plain Jane for that era.
Yeah.
Like, to us, we would think she's, like, gorgeous, beautiful. She has this classic beauty. But her eyes are, you know, wide set, and her skin is just, you know, pale. And she doesn't have a lot of color in her lips. And so a lot of people just figured she was an ugly duckling. Like, MGM, what's his name? Louis B. Mayer. Louis B. Mayer would always call her, hey, you're my little hunchback.
My little hunchback, yeah.
Yeah.
In between gropes. Like, she was getting groped as a young child on set by Mr. Mayer. So.
Well, it's okay. She was one of the ugly ones.
Yeah.
Okay. That is weird. It's, I don't quite, okay, we're going to talk about A Star Is Born in a second. But I kind of have a hard time following that, because Richard, like you said, like I'm not like into Judy Garland, but she's really pretty.
I think she's really pretty too.
And she's in all three movies. She's like the prettiest woman in all three movies, I think. And I feel like it's sort of objective. And you know, there are other things. I guess I can see some things why she was like, you know, the gay community accepted her, but just because of that, that doesn't negate her like just objective attractiveness. You know.
So when they first started filming Wizard of Oz, they slapped on a blonde wig.
They did.
Right, like they were trying to make her Shirley Temple that could sing.
Yeah, she had this like Alice in Wonderland long blonde wig with a bow in her hair and lots of makeup. I think it was the director that they credit for the movie. There was a lot of directors, but it was like Victor Fleming that was like, no, wipe that away. She's a young girl from Kansas. Like, we don't need a glam makeover here.
Yeah.
Okay, well, there's a scene like this in A Star is Born. Maybe I should talk about it.
Let's do it.
You ready? Go.
All right. Okay, so Star is Born, first of all, it starts out, there's a big city, and there are, like, bat signals everywhere. And, like, I'm like, is Batman in this movie? But no, it's just searchlights because it's the big, huge, just variety show in town, right? And the main guy, Norman Maine, he's on the bill, but the producer is like, no, get him off the bill. He is drinking again, and you know what? He's a great guy. But you just don't want to hang out with them. That's kind of what he says. And so Judy Garland is in another band. And Norman Maine comes along and he stumbles onto stage while she's there. And she sees it. She's noticed it. She's singing and dancing. And so in order to kind of do a favor, just give a solid for a fellow performer, I suppose, she kind of takes him and sort of dances with him. They kind of do sort of a, I would call it a Weekend at Bernie's routine, you know? And then she allows him his moment rather than, you know, wetting his pants on stage like Bradley Cooper did in that one movie. And
I haven't seen it yet.
Okay, don't worry, Roy. I'll edit that out of the podcast.
By the way, I'm kind of itching now to do a podcast where we do movies that have been redone three times. Not reboots, but like A Star is Born that have simply been redone three
times. Right,
anyway.
So next time we talk about A Star is Born, we can see all three other Star is Born movies.
Including the one where Bradley Cooper wets his pants on stage, apparently.
That's not official.
Allegedly.
I was going to mention during this particular number, the outfit she's got going on, like Judy's got nice gams.
Yes.
So, yeah.
I think this Star is Born wins the Judy Gam Award for the podcast. Yes. James Mason, he is just really mad anyway. He breaks all the mirrors backstage. He does all sorts of stuff. But he makes friends with Judy Garland. Her name is Esther Blodgett. And he says, okay, he says to, you know, his pals, you know, we should do something with this girl. And they're like, you know, whatever. He hangs out with her. He finds her at the hangout spot where even though they've been singing till like 4 a.m, they go to a club and she and her band and they just sing because they like singing there. And he's like, very impressed with that. And
it's a heck of a song.
Yeah. So they have a lot of fun. They're forming a connection and, she says to her piano player, you know what? You know, he sees something in me. We've been doing this for a long time, and I love you guys, and I love my job, but it's time to, you know, just really try to become a star. To be born a star, is what she says. She doesn't say that. So she quits, and then the weirdest thing, Norman Maine just doesn't catch up with her, but there's this weird sequence where they miss each other, but then they do catch up with each other, and then they literally mail in their performances on postcards to the studio. Because that's what this movie is from now on. Well, in this section, it's just the – you always talk about the PowerPoint presentation and the credits, Roy. But this is in the middle of the movie where they just do a PowerPoint presentation of of photographs of James Mason and Judy Garland.
And her trying out at different places and her showing her scrapbook around to the studios.
Yes. And not since – Not since Baby Girl turned into a wheel and rolled around the stage, I had never been, my mouth had never been more agape than watching a movie.
I assumed it was like going to be, okay, well, this is going to be a couple minutes. And then like an hour later, as we're still neck deep in the slideshow. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So anyway, they miss each other, but they connect and they do. Anyway, he uses his influence, gets her into the studio, and he puts her into the system, and they put her through the studio machinery. And at one point, the surgeons are discussing a head job. I don't know what that means. I assume it means they just they like take a sander and just shave down her skull somehow. But anyway, they put her through the treatment and they turn her into some kind of glam Romulan person. But Norman Maine is like, you guys aren't seeing the beauty in her like I see. And then he wipes all the makeup off. He turns everything and, you know, and he gets the studio to just kind of to just let her be Judy Garland, which she is. And eventually, after doing some weird extra work where it's just her arm in the scene, she's in a movie where it's okay. Here's the funny thing about showbiz. Showbiz likes to make movies about showbiz, but this movie, the Judy Garland movie in the movie, is about a woman who is discovered and becomes a star in the movie A Star Is Born. So it's like meta upon meta. It's like, how much more meta can you get? None more meta. And
her name has changed now.
Her name is now Vicky Lester, which actually sounds like a name that you would, that would be someone's original name.
not the new stage name. Yeah. So my stage name is Trent Wren. Did either of you try the movie star name generator?
I didn't do the movie star name generator.
Well, that's okay.
Oh, I can do it when it's not my movie. Okay. So that's her big movie, and she sings her guts out, and she's sings a song called Born in a Trunk, and it takes 15 minutes, and it's glorious and spectacular, and Norman Maine is proud of her. And then the movie ends. Or so I thought, because it's just intermission. She says they declare their feelings for each other, and they decide to get married. She kind of convinces him. He's like,
it's a fun scene, isn't it? Because like it's during one of her rehearsals, and then like her and Richard are kind of talking, but the boom mic is recording, and then they play back everything they were talking about.
I really don't appreciate those Teamsters recording their private conversation.
But they weren't going to get married, but they were Teamstered into getting married.
Yeah, they were. They were like, if there's one thing I disapprove of, it's like public proposals, and I especially don't like public proposals that where they don't know they're public. So. shame for the audio department. Shame. So anyway, but Norman Maine has a big problem with his press guy named Libby. And he really doesn't appreciate that Norman Maine isn't allowing, you know, like the marriage and like some other aspects of Norman Maine's life, you know, to be able to be, you know, utilized to, you know, to for positive press for the company and stuff like that. And, you know, cause that's his job. He's up against corner. So yada, yada, yada. The thing is, Esther Blodgett wins the Oscar, but then Norman Maine comes up and he stumbles up and he smacks her in the face. And it's a big embarrassing disaster. And she, pretty much decides to leave acting and take care of him. And, let's just skip ahead. He is doing okay, but he has a fight with Libby at the Kentucky Derby, and he goes back on the wagon or off the wagon. Anyway, he's on whatever wagon has all the booze on it. And he falls down again, and the main movie producer, Oliver Niles, you know, he just kind of says, you know, he'll never be the same, he'll never work again, and she's like, well, this is – no, I'm taking care of him forever. And then he says to her – he overhears all that, and he says, I'm just going to go for a swim. You're great. And he pretty much – well, not pretty much. It's pretty – he kills himself, although it would be very difficult to just kill yourself by walking into the ocean. He does it.
So
he's
hard.
He's that determined. He musters all the determination he can to he like from not being in movies, and he gets the job done finally. For the first time in years, he gets the job done.
I think it's a romantic idea of walking yourself into the ocean and drowning yourself, although suicide isn't romantic. But I'm not sure, like, how, unless he genuinely can't swim, I don't know how you drown yourself at a beach intentionally.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, you got to do what sheer Virginia Woolf did and just, you know, you have to have weights or something, you know. But anyway, so she has a very traumatic funeral, and she's going to quit anyway, but her original piano player, pretty much the guy who was possibly in love with her all along, he says, you know what? He died for nothing unless you sing. And so she keeps singing. And she's convinced to go on.
So it was fascinating because
she's born.
At her place, when Norman is overhearing her conversation with the guy, right? Like, so the thing that he says to Vicky before he leaves is that Norman Maine overhears is, he says, goodbye, Vicky Lester, and good luck for Mrs. Norman Maine. And then at the very end of the movie, right, like her final line at the end of the movie is she introduces herself as Mrs. Norman Maine. Yeah. So is it sweet? Is it heartbreaking? It kind of both, I guess.
Yeah.
Yes. It's sweet breaking, I would call it, maybe.
So, Richard, I must assume that you've seen the original version of this film?
Yes, the Janet Gaynor version.
Do any of the songs carry over?
So, that was the big change from the 1937 A Star Is Born to the 1954. The plot, the lines, the storyline, everything is about the same, except for instead of making her a Hollywood actor, they make her a Hollywood singer, like Judy Garland. So, it made more sense to do a musical. So no songs actually translate because she's just a regular, if you could call it that, a regular Hollywood actor that doesn't sing. Yeah. So that's what they added for this version. And subsequently, in the Babs version, in the Lady Gaga version, now it has become a musical because of Judy.
Oh. Do any of the songs carry over from this version to the Babs or Lady Gaga version? Or are there any songs that remain the same, or do they just redo the music for every iteration?
They redo the music for every iteration. I think in the Lady Gaga version, she's humming like Somewhere Over the Rainbow or something as a nod to Judy, but like they don't actually reuse any of the music on
that. Would
unfortunately
be amazing if the Lady Gaga version was just like they just transferred all the songs and Lady Gaga was just singing all the Judy Garland songs. I think that would be funny.
I would watch a shot for shot remake of this with Lady Gaga because I think she could do it.
Yeah. I would be interested in that. We wouldn't get the biggest song of 2018 or whatever that was.
So. You have to do a new song so it could get nominated for the Oscar. That's what it is. Yeah.
There you go. So we haven't really mentioned this, and maybe it's just not necessary, but Judy Garland has an extraordinary voice. Like, she has such a powerful voice. I mean, there's maybe like three or four female vocalists that I can think of in the history of singing that have like a voice like hers. She's got an extraordinary voice.
She does. And it's very unique. I've never heard anyone quite like Judy, like sing in her specific vibrato and her big booming voice. And like we said, her stature is really small. So for that big voice to come out of someone so small, I think that's what marketed her to the public. And that's why everyone went to her concerts or watched her films because they were just so impressed.
Yeah.
So we probably have to talk about, two things. The two things I know about Judy Garland is that she's a diva and she's a big part of the gay community. But I was really surprised. I don't know. I mean, I don't know if she was part of the gay community, like, or associated with the gay community way back then, because I found it very surprising that most of her musical numbers, she wasn't dolled up and gowned up. Like, most of her numbers, she was, like, kind of in drag. Right? Like she was in pants for most of these. And so I'm like, oh, is this her scene already?
Yeah, it's interesting. A lot of people later in her career, like in the 60s, noticed that the homosexuals were drawn to Judy, that she had a gay audience. And they would ask her about it, and she would say, I sing to people. I don't care who they are. I sing to people. And then she like would later comment that she was downtrodden her whole life by the media, by reporters, by managers, by studios. And so she would hate to have anyone that comes to see her show in the audience feel any kind of, you know, downtroddenness, to feel, you know, repressed, like she's felt her whole life. So I believe that there were hints along the way. Maybe not quite in 1954 did people know, but you're right. She was like...
Someone in this movie kind of made a decision for androgyny, right?
Right.
Like for her, like her kind of star, and I don't know if it's like almost like maybe it's associated with like what Norman Main said is like, okay, this isn't who you are. And he wiped her makeup off and he like said, and it's just like, okay, the new star, the star that is born is not, you know, the platinum bombshell that we've been dealing with in Hollywood for the past 40 years. This is a new star and they wanted to do it that way. Yeah.
So, and it's in, the story is like, as far as reflecting real life, is an interesting role reversal. So you might know better than myself, Richard, but at this point in her career, like she's already difficult to work with. She's already showing up late to filming and rehearsals and causing the movie to go past like filming schedule and budget. And so she kind of like, she's in real life at this point in her life, she's kind of the Norman Maine. And I think that is even more so for the third movie we're going to talk about. I mean, she's kind of already struggling with a lot of things at this point. Is that accurate?
100% accurate. It was very interesting when I was looking through the special features of the Star is Born DVD. They had this interview with a reporter, and it was such a PR stunt. Like, you could tell that they were scripted. And she's like, I'm here in the home of Judy Garland, who just filmed A Star is Born. Now, this movie took 5 to 7 months to film, Judy. Can you speak to that? She's like, well, a movie of this caliber, of this budget, normally would take 5 months to film, but they kept adding, you know, shoot dates And Judy, we heard there were rumors that you would only work 2 hours a day on the set. And she's like, well, that's true, but you have to know that a star would want to make it word perfect before she came on the set. And so there's a lot of work that goes on off stage. And if you prepare the show off stage, then you have a good... Anyway, totally a PR stunt, because like you said, she was on the pills again. She had postpartum depression after Lorna Luft was born. And then by the end of this movie, she's pregnant with her son, Joe. And the hormones that happen when you're pregnant and you're dealing with mental fatigue and different addictions with amphetamines and stuff. Yeah, she was already a tough pill to swallow at this point in her career. She had been fired from MGM by 1950, where she had been contracted since she was 13. And it was really funny because in that interview, too, she's like, well, and you haven't done a film in quite some time. She's like, oh, yes, I've been waiting to do this film because this film will be a really big one for me. And it'll be. And I looked at the dates and I'm like, she didn't do a film for 4 years. And they said that was such a long time not to be seeing Judy. In my head, I'm like, some actors don't do a film every couple years. Some actors are taking breaks or raising their kids and then they come back 5 years later. It's the norm, but back then they just worked these people to death.
Yeah, when she was a teenager, there was a point like where she was pumping out a movie like every 3 months, right?
But and that was the expectation, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, it seems like some of that should roll over, you know, like roll over minutes. Like this should count toward the 4 years where you're not working.
But right. It's crazy, right? Like, so this is like her big comeback at the age of 32, right? I mean, it's crazy that a female... actor in Hollywood needs to stage a comeback at the ancient age of 32, right?
Right. It was so terrible that this was the big comeback and it ultimately failed because of things that were outside of their control.
You know, the whole movie is like this. It's a little bit meta again, but she says, you don't know what it's like to watch someone crumble. Love isn't enough. Sometimes I hate him. I hate going home and listen to his lies. I hate me too because I failed too. And you know, obviously Norman Maine is sort of a stand-in for Judy Garland and what she's going through. And I'm like, oh, is this an intervention, you know, from her friends? You know, it's like, how can it not be? But then I'm also thinking, it's not an intervention. It's a PR ploy. Everybody knows who Judy Garland is. Everybody knows the trouble she's going through. And so I kind of feel like A Star Is Born is a little bit more of a, maybe a perverse voyeurism, like making Judy Garland say those lines and deal with someone going through the same troubles that she's going through. And like, that's sort of the appeal of the movie. So is this movie, is it kind to her or is it taking advantage of her?
Right. I think both, because like you say, we're staging Judy's comeback, but we're giving her a character. And because the character opposite her is an alcoholic, is someone dealing with depression and then ultimately takes their own life, not a gentleman Hollywood star wanted this role. And it, there was like a short list of 10, 15 actors that all said, no, thank you. No, thank you. Until finally we have, James Mason do it. And I think you're right. I think they're building this up, touting it as this is Judy's comeback. She's dealing with someone that has problems and she forgives him and you should forgive Judy. But I think she wanted it. Like, I don't think it was taking advantage of her because her husband was a producer on the film and she wanted to do A Star Is Born ever since she did the radio show version in 1942. She was like, I like this story. I think it's my story. I think we could do something with this. And the fact that Warner Brothers was ordered to drastically cut scenes from the movie, that's why the version we have is like the 1983, like cobbling together and restored version of what they saw on the Hollywood premiere night that was so popular. All the stars were out. All the people that were at that premiere, the reviewers, the newspapers, they said, this is a hit. Judy's come back. This is a star vehicle. Everything about this movie's great. But then they're like, oh, we're not going to make a lot of money on it unless it goes in the theater and we could replay it 6 times a day instead of 4 times a day. So they butchered a lot of the Norman Maine, Esther Blodgett relationship. And then you would watch the movie with all the cut scenes out and not understand what the movie meant, and it didn't have that emotional pull that it should have anyway. And that's why it was a big blunder and a sad, like, backfire of a comeback. Yeah.
So weird that, like, way back then, they were thinking, it's like, oh, no, we have to have this many showings in a theater. And I guess maybe more people went to the theater in general, but it just seems like there's never been a point of history where if you wanted to go see a movie, you couldn't see it. It's like, oh, I can't see it because it's not playing 5 times at this theater instead of 4 times this theater. Yeah. Right. It's weird.
It is weird. And they burned all the negatives and to get the nickel out of it. So like, That's why we have the production stills that are so terrible.
We have the terrible postcards.
Yeah.
Mailing it in.
Literally. And I told this to Roy, but I'll tell it to you, John, that I wish now that we're in 2022 that they couldn't just do a CGI version of this, or at least the pictures make them more animated. Like, you know how they do documentaries nowadays and they'll show you a still picture, but they'll zoom in on it and there's 3 dimensions to it and it looks HD. You could do that, but they just won't do it.
Yeah. It's funny. It was just pretty much just like, this is what this is. We're going to lean into the lo-fi-ness of it. Yeah. I feel like they could have tried a little harder.
Yeah. Because we have all the audio of the full cut of the movie, and that's why we have the soundtrack that's uninterrupted. It's just the picture that they burned down to get their nickels and dimes, you know?
Whatever. I forgot to mention that Norman and Esther got married in a jail.
Yeah.
That was a fine choice. Yeah. But that's all I forgot to mention. Anyway, interesting. A Star Is Born. I have now seen half of The Stars Are Born. If that's the way you say that.
I'm 25% of The Stars Are Born.
Yeah. All right.
Well, are you guys ready to watch starring Jack Klugman, or talk about starring Jack Klugman, I Could Go On Singing?
Yes.
All right.
Yeah, let's do this.
Richard, it's all you.
It's all me. Okay. I did not do a great job of writing down a summary for the movie, but I do know the gist of it is okay. Jenny Bowman is a successful singer. She is doing a residency in London. And I just have to point out that Judy Garland, around that time in her life, moved to London to do a residency there. So I really feel like the lines are even more blurred, like From a Star is Born to I Could Go on Singing, that we're seeing someone called Jenny, but you might as well just call her Judy.
Yeah.
And she's very successful, and she visits David Dawn. And David Dawn is Mr. Doctor, and he is going to treat her, but you could tell that they know each other. And how they know each other is they bore a child together. And in an odd twist of fate, back then and even to this day, usually the mother would get custody of the child. But because Jenny Bowman is married to her career, she told David, Matt will be yours, and I will never see him again because I have a career. It's fine. But being back in London, it makes her like yearn for a relationship with this son that she doesn't know. And she basically begs David to at least one time, let me see him just one time, David. I just want to see him. And so he acquiesces. And I think that they go ahead and watch him in a production of, is it Pirates of Penzance? Am I right on that?
Or is it the HMS Pinafore?
Oh, it was the HMS Pinafore. To me, those musicals are all very similar. Yeah. So I just... but... they were cross-dressing in the play because it was an all-boys school, and I thought that was very appropriate. I thought that
yeah,
it was great. And they were after the show was over, just like Judy Garland in A Star Is Born, you could go on singing after you've already done a performance. She's like singing with them, and the whole cast.
She's
is
mostly
like,
rapping with them, though.
yeah, and I'm sure some of the behind the scenes here is this is the last film that Judy Garland ever was in. And she hadn't sung From a Star is Born to this film in a movie. So there's a lot of sordid history there, but I'm sure that was her A-plus effort, which the studio, which this is another MGM movie. They had already fired her and now we're doing another one, but they were probably disappointed in her performances and they had to edit just if she didn't sound good or she was rapping or she was just like making up script, which she did. Like sometimes she wouldn't even have the lines memorized and she would make it up and they'd be like, this is as good as we're going to get. So keep filming her because we don't know. but anyway, she's going to move on in her tour from London to Paris and she strikes up this relationship with Matt while David is away on business. Matt comes to see her perform at, was it the London Palladium or something?
Yeah, that's right. Palladium.
Yeah.
And in real life, Judy was often performing at that venue, so another meta thing. And since he's out of town, David's gone, she has Ida, her publicist or her
fixer.
Her fixer, exactly.
Her muscle.
Yeah. She's like, you'll take care of this. Matt and I just want to go see the sights and have some bonding time together. I think that'd be wonderful. And so basically kidnaps, like Roy, you said on Facebook, kidnaps her own flesh and blood son, but she does not have custody. So this is an Amber Alert. And it's not until many days later that David finds out what happens. And David's like, Matt, you're coming with me. He goes, yes, sir. Right away, sir. Whatever you say. And then Jenny's depressed, and she's calling Matt on the phone and saying, oh, I was waiting for you to call. It was Matt that called her from a payphone, I think. Mm-hmm. Oh, I was waiting for you to call. Are you going to come with me to Paris? And once she realizes that his tone has shifted, she's like, because I was thinking you shouldn't come with me to Paris, and you should do your studies, and you should go off and live your own life and forget about me. And anyway, this leads to her getting really depressed, and she has a show, and, you know, the Dr. David comes in to be like, everyone's waiting for you. And she's like, well, I've sprained my ankle. I can't go on. I mean, the movie's called I Could Go On Singing, but I just don't want to. It's not because of you. It's me. I decide if I can sing or not, and I just don't want to do it. And he's like, I'll stay with you until you get your, you know, yourself back on your feet. I'll be there for you. So she goes on stage. She does her rousing number of I Could Go On Singing, and she looks in the wings, and David's there, but then the audience gives her juice and fire to keep performing, and she looks backstage again, and he's gone, and the movie ends. And and she was willing to, like, go to the courts to try to get custody of her son. We had a lot of unanswered questions, but the movie's over because she is back on stage.
So is the movie saying Judy Garland? Okay. Is the movie saying it's like some people, their family and their children is singing and it's the stage, and like, you know, it's like, don't take both. Don't get greedy because, you know, your place is here. Is that what the movie's saying?
I think, again, if we're going for the meta story is Judy Garland had three children that she had trouble keeping custody of because she was married to the stage and that was her life. And they kind of have this script that originally was called The Lonely Stage, and they adapted it to be a musical for Judy Garland. And yeah, I think that's the message. You can either have your children or have your career, but it's really hard to have both. And her decision is kind of made even if she doesn't realize that that's what she's decided.
Here's my next question. Is every Judy Garland work actually about Judy Garland and not the work?
I think we're learning that that's exactly what it's all about.
Huh. Well, she plays herself really well, right?
Yeah.
So you guys,
I don't know if I could play myself that well.
You guys have such a wild take on this movie. So if I had summed up the movie, I would have said Jack Klugman manages a diva singer who is having trouble with her family, and he just needs to get her on stage on time. And in the end, when he's about to give up, he succeeds, and she gives a rousing show. And that's the Jack Klugman story.
Yeah, that happened.
Here's the way I would sum it up. Judy Garland discovers that she has a husband and son, but she also discovers that they're just way too British for her.
They really are.
And it's just a collision of worlds that will never happen.
Yeah. I will say it's odd that when the father took custody, when Dirk Bogarde takes custody of his son, he pretends that he's the adoptive father when he's the birth father.
Yeah. Yep.
And he's like, oh, I did that because I wanted my wife also to be the adoptive parent. We were both going to pretend we were equally adoptive parents.
It's weird.
I was like, that's weird.
Yep. So isn't that weird? Like, there's some kids
his son does not look anything like his father, hopefully.
There's kids who learn later on in life that who they thought were their real parents were actually adoptive parents, but not this kid. He's like, I thought you were my adoptive father, right? Has yep. The reverse shocking reveal.
And it was a shocking reveal. Did you surmise that he was standing right behind them?
Oh, yes. I think that was, if that hadn't been the case, I would have thrown the TV to the ground.
Here's okay, my impression of that scene, just yelling at top volume, Matt is not, what do they say? They say, you know, this is not fair to Matt, and he needs to know, and he needs all this, and why have you been keeping Matt from me, and what is going on, and Matt needs to know, and then just at the top of their lungs, and then very quietly, Judy Garland says, but I'm his mother. And then that's the thing that Matt hears. I don't know where he was when they were just like, I don't know how thick the walls are of you know, David's apartment or wherever they are, because he didn't hear any of that yelling, but he only heard when Judy Garland was whispering the tiny little thing. I don't know. He should have seen it coming. I also think, but if he doesn't see it coming, another aspect of this movie, and I thought the movie was kind of going this way, is, you know, Matt is hanging out and, you know, I mean, let's look at it from his perspective. Just randomly, a kind of celebrity singer just kind of says, oh, hey, Matt, I'm really interested in you. Why don't you come to Paris with me? Why don't you come to my show? I'll comp you tickets. You can sit here. You can do all this. And I don't know. I was kind of picturing Matt going to all his friends. Like, I got a date with Judy Garland, and I am dating her. I thought that might be where.
Yeah, can you imagine, like, to. If you're just like some kid, you don't know who your mom is, but Adele, like, somehow shows up in your life and wants to take you all around town, and
or Lady Gaga shows up,
right? Yeah, and we don't know if Matt grows up to be heterosexual or homosexual, but I feel like it even better if he's gay growing up, because he's like, Judy Garland was into me and I loved it, but it's just. Turns out just to be his mom, so yeah. There you go.
So, anyway, I could go on singing.
Right.
I think it was fun. Oh. I never heard of this movie, and I'm surprised it was just not streaming anywhere.
So I know. So it's weird because we feel like this is like the end of her career. You can't even stream this movie anywhere. But when was this movie? Was this 62, 64?
1963.
So 1963 is when she became the first woman to win a Grammy for Best Album of the Year. Which is
Go Judy.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's crazy.
Crazy.
So women weren't in music before 1963.
There was not a woman who was singing before 1963. Yeah.
I rather enjoy women singing.
Yeah. Oh man, I've really so lately. Yeah. I've really been getting into Linda Ronstadt, who again has like a booming voice, right? Like an incredible voice for such a tiny little thing. Listening to a lot of Dolly Parton. I love Karen Carpenter. I finally got around to buying some Aretha Franklin, but I don't know. I've been into female vocalists in a big way for the last month or so.
Oh, Karen Carpenter. Yeah. What a voice there.
Yep.
Very different voice, right? It's just, it's like not even a babbling brook, just a smooth brook.
So soothing. Yeah. It's like strong but smooth, right? It's like the dude's fist. It's like it hurts, but it's so soft, right? Whereas Judy Garland is Judy Garland's voice is like the White Stripes. There's only two tiny little people playing music, but they're making an enormous amount of noise, right?
Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah. Yeah. So,
and I'm sorry, we hinted around this that she was a pill to work with. So,
yeah,
I just have to add that she didn't even read the script by the time she got to London. And when she read it, she's like, "I can't perform this crap. It's too close to my real life." So they had to like finesse her down from her little pedestal, and they're like, "No, we'll change it. Don't worry. We'll make it less like you."
Originally, the character's name was Julie.
Yeah. Yeah, so the poor
Judy Darland
production team, like, yeah, Julie Garter. Like, the production team had to deal with a lot. She would lock herself in the bathroom. She wouldn't come on the set. There was times when Ronald Neim, who directed the film, would get a call from the studio, and they're like, "So, do you have enough footage of Judy to finish the movie without her?" He's like, I need I Could Go On Singing, because they had scheduled to shoot I Could Go On Singing, that whole big number with the broken leg or the sprained ankle and the audience and her making her big comeback. And he's like, "I really need that." And she was like 5 hours late that day, and they filmed it, and they're like, "Phew, we have a movie now." And the whole monologue that I've been paying homage to all podcasts was just her riffing, her improvising lines. And so if we thought that was about Judy, where she's like, "You think you can make me sing, or Ida? You can get me there, sure, but can you make me sing? I sing for myself. I sing when I want to, whenever I want to, just for me. I sing for my pleasure. Whenever I want to. Do you understand that?" And so they're like, "I don't think we're going to get this take again." So cameraman go in, lighting diffuser come in. And so they're like zooming in. And do you recall during that scene, she had this like highlight on her eyes?
Uh-huh.
It was so weird, but they were trying to follow her because they're probably like, "We will never be able to shoot this again. So we need to just
Yeah.
So what you're saying, that just wasn't part of the movie. That was just documentary footage. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. Holy cow. So I feel like then Ivan Drago is the Judy Garland of Russian boxers, who is out there doing it for himself, win, lose, or draw.
He does it for me.
It's not for you. It's for me. Yeah.
See, I mean, and I'll say this again. We talked about this when we talked about Rocky IV. There's a weird, like, literary irony to Rocky IV because Ivan Drago, he does the, you know, self, you know, the you know, kind of the capitalist idea. The self is more important. I'm in it for me. I'm doing it for me. And then Rocky's big speech is like, we can be a community, a communism community, if you will. Yeah. So Drago and Rocky change places. Rocky's a communist. Good for them. Okay. Okay, I'm done talking about the stars. I don't want to transition yet, Roy. That's your job to go ahead and give the go-ahead.
Oh, wow. All right. Well, these are the three movies we've been talking about. Unless you have any further notes or comments you'd like to make, Richard, we are going to go to a commercial break. But I'll give you last round with the mic. There you go.
I love Judy Garland. There you go.
Oh, very good. All right. So now let's turn to commercial break. John, you do this part.
Is this the part where
we give the contact information? Please don't edit any of this out. This all needs to stay in.
Find us on email, yoursminetheirspodcast@gmail.com. Go ahead and find us on the blog, yoursminetheirspodcast.blogspot.com. You can download directly all those MP3 files and listen to – you can hear our Rocky IV conversation. That was fun. Find us on Apple Podcasts. Give us 5 stars and leave whatever review you want. Find us on Spotify. Give us 5 stars there or the Spotify equivalent. Find us on Stitcher. I think we're there too. Also, find us on Facebook. Facebook's really fun because we post all the links to all the individual podcasts. And that's where you get to hear Roy's note-taking and see his note-taking and comment on his note-taking. That's a lot of fun. And do the polls. The polls are where you decide which genres of movies we watch and which movies within those genres we watch. You have so much power there, you wouldn't believe it.
Enormous amounts of power.
While I'm still talking, though, also, and we're going to mention this, I think we're going to mention this at the end of the podcast, so stay tuned. By the time you listen to this, the Friday coming up, that's when our live event will be at the Post Theater at the University of Utah campus on Friday, the 1st of July. And we're going to be there from pretty much 10 a.m. to 9 p.m. We're going to be watching all the movies that we're going to be doing next time. They're detective movies. We're watching Clue, Vertigo, and The Fugitive. And you're welcome to come. We want you there. So if you need any more info, you can contact us at the places that we mentioned. But we're going to talk about that more at the end of the podcast, I think.
Oh, I'm so excited. Yeah. Remind me to mention the thing that we're going to try to do with Clue that's probably going to be a terrible failure.
Okay. I'll try to remember to do that. That's not the most enthused I've been for an event that we've done, but, I'll remember. Don't worry.
All right. You guys want to do some awards?
Yeah.
Okay.
Let's do it.
Let me talk about these movies real quick as far as stats. So Rotten Tomatoes, I Could Go On Singing was 100%. A Star Is Born 98 and Babes in Arms 90. So our average here is 96%. So this is one of the highest averages that we've had for a set of three movies. So well done, Richard.
Thank you.
Budget wise, I don't have much to go on here. A Star Is Born cost $5 million and made $4.4 million. And Babes in Arms cost $750,000. I don't know how much money it made. So not much else to go on, but what really matters is what the three of us think of these three movies. So this is what's going to be immortal. All right, Richard, what's your favorite title?
I think I'm basing the title for my favorite on how many words are in the title.
Hmm.
So there's 3 words in Babes in Arms. There's 4 words in A Star Is Born. But there is 5 words. 5 words and I Could Go On Singing. And that's
5 words equals 5 stars.
Yep.
I agree with Richard. I could go on singing. It kind of, it's right there in the title that maybe you even know what might happen after the movie's over.
Yeah. Okay, well, I went with Babes in Arms. I assumed it was going to be about hot chicks at war, and it wasn't. But but it's still a lovely title. So, okay. Best movie poster, John.
All right. Well, it's I Could Go On Singing. Most of the poster just says, "It's Judy!"
What do you think, Richard?
I had to go with the jazz hands, Judy Garland in A Star is Born.
Yeah, so that's a good one. This was a tough choice, but I also went with It's Judy. I like the black, the red, and the white. Also very white stripes-ish. Yeah. And then it looks like she's strangling a ghost, but it's Judy. So, all right. Richard, we're going to do all of this at the same time. So tell us your favorite tagline from one of the posters, and then you give us your three alternate taglines that you would have written for the posters.
Perfect. I picked my favorite. I Could Go On Singing because Judy is lighting up the lonely stage. And my alternate for all of them or just that one?
For each one.
All right. My alternate for that is I Could Go On Singing, This Is About Me, Judy. It's me, Judy. And then A Star is Born. A Star is Born, the autobiography of Judy Garland. See? A theme here. And then Babes in Arms, This Isn't Your Mama's Musical.
Okay. John, what do you got?
Okay, well, I picked a different tagline from the I Could Go On Singing poster, and my tagline is, It's Judy!
So I picked that one as well.
Okay, yeah. My Babes in Arms tagline is, Don't worry, USA, the black-faced teens have everything under control. My Star is Born tag is, With Judy Garland as the star and James Mason as the black hole. And my I Could Go On Singing tagline is, I could also go on spurring my de-estranged son's edible complex.
Yay!
Okay. Well, my favorite tagline is, It's Judy! Alternate taglines, Babes in Arms. I put, Hey kids, your parents can't stand it, but you are going to really dig opera. A Star is Born. Judy makes her end-of-career comeback at the unthinkable age of 32. I Could Go On Singing. She does. So,
all right. Perfect.
All right, John, your favorite opening credits.
Opening credits, A Star is Born because it's just Judy Garland in big, giant red letters in CinemaScope.
Yeah, that's my pick, too. What about you, Richard?
Same.
Yay. All right, best titular line. I hope we explained this one well to you, Richard. Do you have one?
The titular line of the movie that I picked as my favorite? I think so. I said, I am Mrs. Norman Maine. Is that okay?
Oh, so we didn't explain this well. That is lovely, though. So I guess
sorry about that. No. Yeah, you needed to have explained it, but that's what I picked.
We're bad
even
hosts.
If it's wrong.
So
no, you're fine.
So the titular line is when they say the name of the movie in the movie.
Oh, shoot.
Yeah.
I feel like then I would have to move it over to I Could Go On Singing because Judy Garland sings a song saying I Could Go On Singing Till the Cows Come Home.
Yeah, she does. John, what do you got?
Okay, the line when she sings, I'm just a babe in arms where you're concerned, but here's the twist, she sings that in the movie A Star is Born.
Oh, yeah, that's right. No, she absolutely does.
Yeah.
Okay, so from Babes in Arms, I've got two arms, babes in arms. And I think that Billy Idol was singing that part. So.
Or Billie Eilish.
All right, John, your favorite technology.
Favorite technology, I'm going to go with the studio head job that they were going to give Judy Garland, which I believe involved drilling holes in her skull and doing some sanding and draining some of her brain fluid out. Just a complete head job.
All right. Richard, what do you got?
In A Star is Born, they lit the spotlights on fire, and I thought that was great technology.
Oh, good. So I went with scrapbook resumes. You don't see that much, but it's pretty good. Okay, Richard, your favorite name of any of the characters from any of these movies?
Esther Blodgett, Star is Born. Yeah.
Actually really close to her name, right? Ethel.
Mm-hmm.
It's close.
Okay, honorable mention to Florrie Moran, who is Mickey Rooney's mother. Also Cuddles the Orderly in A Star is Born. But I went with Rosalie Baby Essex.
Mm. So I went with Lola Lavery from A Star is Born. I don't even know what character that is.
Oh, I almost...
Lola
Lavery.
Lola.
I think that's the date of the movie producer at the beginning of A Star is Born.
Yeah. Very good. All right, John, your favorite food. It's booze, right? Because I picked booze. What do you got?
No, I didn't pick booze, but I should have. When Judy Garland is the bar hop, she mentions something called the Everything Burger that includes lobster and chop suey in the burger.
Oh, goodness. All right, Richard, did you have a favorite food from these movies?
I said the feast that Mickey had at Baby Essex's house. I was like, whatever he's eating, can't make it out exactly, but he's loving it. It must be very fancy. So that's what I picked.
Hmm. Both of those are better than booze, so I guess you're right. Okay, Richard, your favorite outfit worn by anybody in any of these films?
This was a tough one. I actually went in a weird direction. In A Star is Born, she has this happy hobo outfit. Might be an offensive term, but you know what I mean. She's like got the freckles painted on her face, a short boy wig. Like we said, she dressed in drag. I just thought it was a delightful little outfit.
Is that the lose your face number?
I remember that one. That was good.
Lose your face. Yeah.
Lose your long face. All right, John, your favorite outfit.
Okay, it's actually not one that Judy Garland wears, but in A Star is Born, at the beginning, one of the showgirls, or several of the showgirls, I think, have these pink Native American jumpsuits with the headdresses. And I think you're not supposed to do that, but nevertheless, here we are. That's my favorite outfit.
Trying to one-up the blackface from Babes in Arms. Okay. So, derided and disliked by the designer for the outfits for it could I could go on singing, but the red dress, the beautiful red dress.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's fun. She hated that dress, right?
Edith Head, who was supposed to do the costumes for that one, said, "I didn't pick it and I don't like it." But,
what does Edith Head know? It's funny. Should we all bow to Edith Head? We don't need to, right? Sometimes Edith Head can be wrong. Maybe. I don't know. I like the red dress.
So, yeah, I mean,
Judy like went into her suitcase. She's like, I have a red dress that matches the backdrop. That's what I'll wear.
Yeah, like she matched the curtains perfectly. John, favorite alien?
Favorite alien. Well, it's Judy Garland's world. So my favorite alien is All of Us.
Oh, there you go. All right. What do you think, Richard?
Baby contortionist.
Yes.
Okay, so I went with Jenny from I Could Go On Singing because she's in Jolly London and she's the American. So she's the alien in that
film. Accurate.
Oh, yeah. Okay. All right, Richard. Best special effects.
Don't laugh at me, but the production stills, those postcards, best effect ever. Just it really lost me. I was taken in.
That goes hand in hand with mine, Richard, because my special effects is every part of A Star is Born that's not the photographs.
Okay, so I'm going with whatever CGI magic they did for the Baby Essex's cartwheel extravaganza.
Yeah, I almost picked that.
Yep.
All right, John, your favorite location?
My favorite location is young Matt's 1,000-year-old Hogwarts school.
Oh, man, he's like, see those ruins over there? There's only two walls still standing, but that's where I take biology. Man, okay. All right, Richard, what's your favorite location?
I like the London Palladium. I thought that was cool that they actually shot there.
Oh, Richard, you and I, we're together. I also picked the Palladium. Yay. Very good. Okay, Richard, coming around. Your favorite song? Not to be confused with, we have a special award for the biggest showstopper, but what is your favorite song from these movies?
My favorite song was the one take wonder of A Star Is Born, The Man That Got Away.
That is a really good song.
Yeah.
John, what do you got?
I almost picked Good Morning, but then I switched it. Also in Babes in Arms, the Lucky Star / Barbara Seville medley, because that's, I found it really interesting because Judy Garland was singing Barbara Seville like in modern, modern scat, yeah, jazz, whatever.
Yeah.
And then her sister, right? Was it her sister? Was singing like Lucky Star in opera. So they changed the subject matter of the songs, where the opera song that's like talking about modern times is sung opera, and the song about the Barbara Seville is sung modern. So I thought that was a clever way for them to introduce, like, this is the new way of doing things.
Very good. I chose from A Star Is Born, Gotta Have Me Go With You. I thought that was so catchy. And when you try to listen to it, like on iTunes or whatever, the only version they have is the movie version. So you get the version where he interrupts the performance. But I love that song. I think it's delightful. Okay, John, who's your favorite guest star?
Well, it's got to be Jack Klugman.
I do love Jack Klugman. And Richard, did you ever have the pleasure of watching Space Ghost Coast to Coast?
I did.
Oh, yeah, because Zorak was obsessed with Jack Klugman.
Oh, okay.
All right, well, anyway, Richard, who is your favorite guest star?
I'll just go with you because it doesn't look like I wrote one down, so agreed.
Well, so I'm going to digress. He's my honorable mention, but I'm going to give it to the Wicked Witch of the West.
I was going to – okay. Oh. I have her in another category, so that's why I didn't pick her, okay, too. So.
Good. Good, fair. Yeah.
All right, Richard, external recurring character, meaning a character from a movie that we have done before.
An external recurring character.
Yeah.
Okay, maybe I did it. Maybe I did that wrong.
It's okay. So,
no one's ever done it right. No one ever did.
So, from all the movies we've podcasted before, if someone has repeated from this movie to one, for one of these three movies to one of those, I will
say that Esther from Meet Me in St. Louis and Esther in A Star Is Born, they look alike.
That counts.
Well, there
is
you
that
go.
Okay.
Sure. Well, so, I mean,
they look alike and they have the same name. So
I was just going to go with Judy Garland, who is in all of these movies and was in Meet Me in St. Louis, which we did for Christmas.
Bam. Yes.
Yeah,
you got it.
Yeah. All right, John, what do you got?
Okay. Honorable mentions. Mary Train, who is in Babes in Arms, one of the teenagers there. She was in It's a Wonderful Life as the secretary of the savings and loan.
Oh,
I think,
yeah,
like Cousin Truitt or something like that. Mm. Mickey Rooney was in It's a Mad, 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 Mad World.
Oh, yeah, of course he was.
Yep. And but the winner is, and going way back to Star Trek days, but the Gilbert and Sullivan, the HMS Pinafore song, where it's like, give them a knockdown blow, a knockdown blow. Remember that song, a knockdown blow?
Sure.
That's the song that Data sings when he goes Harry Wire in Star Trek Insurrection. So
amazing.
It's a song. Yeah.
Well, John, who's your internal recurring character? And I'm just going to get out of the way for me. It's Judy Garland. She was in all three of these, if you were paying close attention.
I was not paying close attention.
Okay.
Okay. I honorable mention to just the idea of a showbiz executive who cares about the lives of his contract players, because we saw that in all three movies, which I thought was strange because I thought they were cutthroat. But every single one of them is like, oh, no, I love Norman Maine, or I love Judy Garland, or, you know, your dad was a great guy. And, you know, we really need to care about, we really need to care about Janet, you know, and I don't know. Anyway, that happened a lot. And also, I'm going to be, let's see, the MGM Lion recurred a lot.
Yeah.
And also the composer, Harold Arlen. who composed songs in all three movies. Yeah.
Very
good. Whoa. That's a deep cut, and I loved it.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Well, Richard, do you have an internal recurring character?
I was also going to go with just like Judy Garland, her life.
Yeah.
And everything about her. Yeah, so I agree with you.
Yeah. Okay, well, we're going to come back around, Richard, to the... This is a weird category. The best death? A death you noticed? I don't know. The death category. Who died that you're going to make note of?
Well, Norman Maine walked into the water to drown himself, and he also probably died of a little alcoholism. Probably. So I
picked him as well, and I picture he just slowly walks into the ocean, and his head just, you know, gets lower and lower into the water, and just calmly until, like, the water is then over his head, and then that's it. Like he just escalators into the water, and now he's dead.
Ah, no. Yes. Okay.
Well, John, who's your favorite death?
Well, yeah, Norman Maine. I think it's just so much. It was also, well, I have another category for his death, too, so I'll just stop there.
Okay, me too. All right, John, then who's your favorite villain?
My favorite villain is, honorable mention to Libby, the PR guy at the studio who punches out Norman Maine, gets him back into alcoholism and never appreciated him. And also the person at the funeral who rips Judy Garland's veil off of her because she's like, give me an autograph or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, terrible person. Also, Mickey Rooney's shortness, I feel like, needs to be mentioned somewhere.
As a villain?
Kind of a villain. I think it kept him from being taken seriously. So,
okay.
My winner of the villain are the lousy AV guys who recorded the proposal and then played it in front of everyone.
Oh man.
Yes.
Don't like those guys.
I hate them. All right. Richard, what about you? Who's your villain?
This is where Mrs. Gulch comes in. You know, she came from Wizard of Oz straight into Babes in Arms to be the villain of that film as well. Margaret Hamilton.
She wants them all to attend school. So why went
they're
with
just children? Why would they need that?
I went with Rosalie Baby Essex because she's a villain. She tries to ruin things romantically for our two leads, and also she has evil powers. That's how she does her twisting and turning and flopping and all that stuff. Yeah,
she's so good.
Yeah, if she had been in the movie longer, then she probably would have possessed somebody. So now, hero, though, Richard, who is the hero of these films?
I felt like it was Judy Garland.
Yeah, very good. So I'm going to specify her incredible pipes. Judy's pipes.
Oh, yeah.
Judy's pipes.
Her singing, actually. Okay,
I actually went with Danny, the piano player from A Star is Born, although it can't be disproved that he was just kind of lurking and waiting, you know, kind of the best friend that Judy Garland would cry on because he wanted to marry Judy Garland himself, so he was just lurking the whole movie. But he stays with her the whole movie, and he gives her the speech at the end.
Yeah.
All right, John, what's the best movie goof?
Blackface.
Okay. Was that a goof? All right, what about you, Richard?
I said burning the original negatives from A Star is Born was the biggest goof. Yeah.
So I don't know if you guys noticed, but in A Star is Born, there's like 20 minutes of a junior high slideshow presentation. And I don't know if they noticed when they put the film together, but there it is.
That's a goof.
Yeah. Okay. Goof. All right. Richard, what's the funniest moment?
I just enjoyed Mickey Rooney going over to Baby Essex's house and not knowing how to smoke and not knowing the proper fork to use. I thought that was slapstick and funny.
Yeah, it's good. John, what do you think?
Okay, there's a part where Judy Garland, and it's in A Star is Born at the very beginning, that big, huge production that Norman Maine was drunk at. And there's a part where she has to look at herself in the mirror, and she has to, like, lean down to this mirror, down to her knees. And I just thought that was funny because I think it was implied that Norman Maine broke all the other mirrors backstage. Uh-huh. Like that was the last mirror left.
Oh, that's funny.
That's funny. Okay, so for me, it's like when it's in a Babes in Arms, when the kids gather the adults together to like show them how hot and awesome new. I've mentioned this like 100 billion times. Like, okay, parents, get ready. And then that guy and that girl just sing like the latest opera duet. And I don't know, it was funny in that it was the reverse of my expectations. So, there you go. But key of D minor moment, John, what is the part of these movies that just made you weep instantly?
All right. Well, it's the part just before Norman Maine walks into the ocean where he says, I just wanted to look at you again. When he says, hey, to her, so she would turn around. And he says, I just wanted to look at you again. And then he kills himself.
Oh, all right. Yeah. What about you, Richard?
I'm thinking the monologue that we discussed where Vicky Lester is saying, I'm just trying so hard, but he really wants to stop drinking, but he can't. And I blame myself for failing him. And it seemed real. So that broke me. Hmm.
So I went with Norman crashing the Oscars. That was pretty rough. Mm. Yeah. Honorable mention too, when Matt walks in on Jenny and Dad during the big reveal. I'm your Lady Gaga mother. Okay.
He should have heard them in the other room, but
yeah.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. Well, Richard, what's your best what the heck moment? And it's okay if it's when you got to minute 15 of blackface music and you knew that it wasn't ending anytime soon.
That's it. Yeah. That's what I picked. That's what I wrote down.
All right. What about you, John?
I kind of mentioned the two biggies. First of all, the slideshows, the series of slideshows in A Star Is Born. But also, I mean, I think this has to win, but I wrote it down as Baby's Spine Wheel, where she just rolls around.
Oh, man. Okay. All right. Best quote, John.
Best quote. Okay. Lots of good quotes, but I kind of picked one at random, but I like this quote. And it's when Norman Maine says to her, of course you're scared. We all are. Why wouldn't you be?
Yeah. Very good. What about you, Richard?
It's between Vicky Lester doing the one that I just mentioned, that I thought I was the answer for Norman, but love isn't enough for him. Love is not enough. Or the one that I spoke about earlier where Jenny is like, you think you can make me sing? I sing for my pleasure whenever I want to. Do you understand that? They're both very similar. I think they're very raw and very real. I guess I could go on singing is a little bit more powerful than the one about Norman. But yeah.
So from I Could Go On Singing, the quote I really liked, and it seemed kind of a silly quote, but it also felt like it meant so much more about not the movie, just the movie, but also about Judy Garland. And it's just when she says, nothing I knitted ever fitted.
Oh.
And I thought it was lovely. Okay. Richard, the best scene in these movies.
Because of its length, again, I'm going to give it to Born in a Trunk in the Princess Theater in Pocatello, Idaho. It's a big production number.
Yeah. Like 14 minutes long.
Okay.
John, what do you got?
I went with – okay, this is kind of surprising, but I went with in Babes in Arms – the first rehearsal scene of Mickey's big production that he put together. It's just the rehearsal scene. And the reason I pick that is because it's like one of those – it has this movie moment that I found just really, really lovely. And it's when I think Mickey Rooney and Judy Garland or it might be the other two people, you know, because there are a bunch of people in that production. But someone is singing on the stage and they're doing the number. And on the movie soundtrack, there is a series of strings, like orchestral strings. And as I was watching it, I'm like, gosh, this is such phony Hollywood whatever, because of course there aren't strings in the scene. They just added them in post to boost up the music of this particular scene. But then the camera pans over and you get like 20 little kids playing the strings.
Yeah.
Like, and it was just, that's just a cool thing. I thought it was just really cool because it tricked me for a second and it knew I would do that. It knew I'd be like, where are these strings coming from? Come on. And then it shows the strings.
Yeah. All the little 6-year-old kids who,
yeah,
you don't get your amphetamines until you play.
Yes.
So, all right. So I, it's already been alluded to, but I picked the scene right before Norman Maine's suicide where he overhears the struggle, and then he has his last sweet moment with her, and then you know, walks into the ocean. So there's that. So best actor, John.
Well, I wrote down Judy Garland, but that's before I found out that her lines were just Judy Garland saying lines that they just captured on film. But I guess it still counts.
Okay, very good. Richard, what about you?
I think Judy Garland, because she really did deserve the Oscar for A Star Is Born and not Grace Kelly. So I'm giving it to her postmortem.
Very
good. Now I want to see that Grace Kelly movie, though.
Yeah, that's true. So, all right. So I have honorable mention to Mickey Rooney, who had a scene where he impersonated like several different famous actors and personalities.
Okay, yeah, that was good.
I'm going to give it to Judy Garland specifically for A Star Is Born.
Oh, very good.
And unanswered questions. I have an unanswered question for you guys. Did David take Jenny back, or is he gone? Did he just get her to the stage and he's gone?
I say he's gone. Just gone, gone, gone. He said what she needed to hear at that moment, but he set her on the path to being a singing robot machine.
So was it enough, though, for her? Like, she got on stage, she got her mojo back because she sang, and now she doesn't need him, or is she going to go back after the performance is over and like drink herself to death, and then it's also all over?
Strangely, she seemed kind of okay with seeing him off stage, but then again, maybe she was just putting on a face. But I kind of got the impression that she saw him not there and acknowledged that, okay, he's not there. I am going to fulfill this other calling.
She's
going to
go on singing.
I'm going to fulfill the title of the movie. That's what I should have said. Yeah.
Well, okay. All right. Do you guys have any unanswered questions?
Yes. Richard, go ahead.
Did Jenny get her son back?
I don't think so.
I don't think so either.
I think David and Matt are a package deal, and I think if she doesn't end up with David, she doesn't get Matt.
You can't split up the Britishness like that.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
My question is, did there used to be dancing at the Academy Awards?
Oh.
Is there not dancing now, is what I would pose. I guess I watched the Tonys a lot, and there's dancing there. But you're right. At the Academy Awards, there's not dancing anymore.
Well, I mean, when I say dancing, I mean like the audience dancing.
Oh.
It was more like a cocktail party with people winning awards?
It was like a cocktail party. There was a part where they're like, I think it was like after Norman Maine messed everything up. They're like, okay, let's take a break. And everybody caught up and danced with each other.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's more of a Golden Globes situation.
Yeah, yeah, that's kind of what it seems like. I feel like the Golden Globes must have co-opted that part of it, but I don't know. Okay, my next question is, are surgeons really called Mr.? Because that's not true.
So I asked my surgeon sister-in-law, and she said no. This was in Wee London Town, so who knows?
Maybe it's a London thing, but I swear he was just making that up.
It was 1963. They played fast and loose with those titles.
And my last question is, did David carry Matt as a child? Like, did they work something out? Because he's a famous surgeon, so it just seems like that's the only way that that Judy Garland had no idea who her son was by not carrying the alien child. Yes.
Okay.
Yes. He juniored
Matt. Okay.
It was a shuttlecraft accident, and they had to like surgically remove it from Jenny and put it into David.
Yeah. That's it.
Yeah, I think you're right. That's good. Okay, now we have some special awards. Let's start with the biggest showstopper. Richard, which number was the biggest showstopper?
There was a lot of good ones. Honorable mentions. I had said before that The Man That Got Away was really good. But I think I could go on singing because that was the culmination of the plot of all three films. And she went from like a lull to a I can do this to just like belting it out to the back row of that audience. So I feel like I could go on singing was the biggest showstopper, but I could be swayed by whatever you said.
John, what do you think?
Okay, this is kind of This is coming out of nowhere, kind of, but I picked Hello Bluebird from I Could Go On Singing. Ooh. And the reason is actually kind of the, like, her, I don't know. She did a lot of prep for that song. It, like, prepped me for being a showstopper, because at the beginning of that song, she was off stage and she was, like, squatting, and she was in a squatting, clapping frenzy, because she does this weird thing where she was just, like, really getting into it. She's like, yeah, and she's like, and she's like grunting.
Oh yeah,
like before she goes on stage.
I thought she was going to dance like Sylvester at that point.
Yeah, that's what your note meant. Where she's like, yeah, she does something like that, and so it's just like her pre-pumped got me pumped for the showstopper that was Hello Bluebird. Mm.
So I honorable mentioned The Man That Got Away, and I think if she'd performed that in front of a large audience, that maybe would have won it for me instead of just performing in front of her friends in Norma, Maine. But I went with I Could Go On Singing By Myself, which at the end she's like clenching the fists and she's really belting that number out there. I thought it was great. All right, then.
And she also used that song in her concerts after the film, so that became a big Judy number afterwards. So you got it.
Yeah, I won. I was right. Okay. All right. The most Richard character, John.
Danny the piano player, because I feel like he's there for his friends just constantly through hours of movies.
Okay. So I went with Baby Rosalie because I'm pretty sure that Richard is crazy flexible and could do some body contortion wheeling around.
I really like what you both said, and, you know, I wouldn't know myself as well as people on the outside looking in, but I picked Mickey Moran because even though I'm taller than Mickey Rooney, I just felt like he had a shtick that I like to promote as well, like the, I can go,
I almost picked Mickey.
Yeah, but I liked what you picked ultimately, so yeah.
Nice. Okay. All right, then. John, what's the most Richard scene?
I would say the final Babes in Arms number, where they take America by storm.
Okay. Well, I went with when Norman discovers Vicky at the club, when the talent is discovered and a star is on its way to being birthed. All right. But Richard, what do you say? What is the scene that speaks most to Richard?
I think, I did pick this scene earlier in the show, but that whole production number of Born in a Trunk, I just feel like I would do that. I'd be like, hey guys, I have something to show you. It's just a little number from a musical, and I would go on for 20 minutes. Whether or not they wanted to or not, yeah.
Okay. Wonderful. Okay. Now, you don't get to answer this question, Richard. This is just for me and John. John, what is the most Richard movie of these three?
I say I Could Go On Singing because that's what Richard does. He goes on singing.
That's very good. I think you may be right. I put A Star Is Born, but I think you may be right. So, but we will find out.
Nice.
All right, Richard. It is time to get real. We love the Judy movies, but one of these three is only the third best, and one of them is the best. So, Richard, what is your third favorite of these three films?
Babes in Arms.
Babes in Arms. John, what do you think? Do you agree with that?
I don't agree.
I didn't think
you
would.
I'm going to have to go with A Star Is Born. It's super long, and there are postcards in it.
There are postcards. Okay. All right. My number three is Babes in Arms. And so my number one, by the way, was so good that it overcame some major deficits. So my number two is I Could Go On Singing.
Really?
And okay. So, Richard, you can give us your number two and your number one.
I Could Go On Singing Till the Cows Come Home is my number two.
So you're both in for A Star Is Born.
In fact, yeah. Richard and I had identical picks. Well done,
yeah,
sir.
Yeah, you both did.
Yeah, A Star Is Born, it's my number one.
And I'll have you know that IMDb agrees with the two of us, if it makes you feel any better. I don't know that it would, but there you go. John, I feel like we skipped you somehow.
Yeah, I don't know how that happened.
Yeah, I don't know how it happened. Anyway, well,
the boomerang didn't work. Yeah,
it didn't work.
Should we start the podcast over?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, what are your two? Your number two and your number one.
What do you think?
Okay, so you picked A Star Is Born as your number three. I feel like we're now at the point where every single podcast, the movie that is the consensus best movie, is your number three pick. Like that's just the thing.
I chose first this time.
Yeah.
Didn't I? Oh no! Wait, no, wait. Richard chose, then I chose.
Yeah. So yeah, I'm gonna say I'm guessing your number two is I Could Go On Singing, and your number one is Babes in Arms.
Babes in Arms was awesome. It was my favorite movie. Okay. Yeah. it's got some problems, but I had the most fun with Babes in Arms anyway. So that's how I'm gonna do it.
So A Star Is Born, like that slideshow part was so hard for me to get through, and it just like kept happening. But I thought it was a very powerful film. And I wonder now, like, are the others going to stand up to it? I don't know. I've heard people really like the Lady Gaga version. We should find out sometime.
Yeah.
Well, all right. Well, we're all right, 'cause they're all lovely films. And this is fascinating, Richard, because, well, we're going to go do our live thing and we'll talk about that in a minute. But after that, you're coming back and we're doing 21st century musicals.
Yes.
And then we have a friend who's going to make us watch the movie that has nothing to do with musicals. But after that, one of the categories that we could conceivably be watching would be 1950s musicals. So it could be a real string of music heavy movies in for 3 out of 4 podcasts. So we'll see. We'll see what happens. But now we're down to it, right? Is it future business time?
Yes. Yes. Now, next week is the big thing. So we may as well talk about this now. So this is the thing coming up. Next week, we are meeting at pretty much 10 a.m. at the Post Theater on the University of Utah campus in Salt Lake City. The address, I want to say, if I'm doing this right, yeah, I think it's 245 Fort Douglas Boulevard in Salt Lake City. If you take South Campus Drive and just drive straight up South Campus Drive, then it just runs right into the theater. So you could drive your car into the theater if you just take South Campus Drive into it. So I'm going to try to get everything down. Let's just make sure I don't forget anything. Here's the thing. You can't bring popcorn into the theater. They will not allow popcorn into the theater. We're watching 3 movies, and I'm like, what? But that's fine. I don't care about popcorn that much, but everyone else does. So I apologize about that. To make that up, Katie got a bunch of nibs from work. And so I think
that's for real. She's bringing nibs for real.
Yeah, I think we have a few packages of nibs. We might get a few more. So we have nibs ready to go. But if you do bring your own food in, it has to be like individually wrapped food. You can't bring a big tub of licorice to share with like the whole row, but you can bring like a package of, you know, Halloween Twizzlers or something. Yeah. You can bring a package of Red Vines, but you technically have to eat the whole package of Red Vines yourself.
Now, what about like, so you've got your typical movie theater candy. Can I bring Mike and Ike's or Good and Plenty's?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
You can bring like
Junior Mints.
Yeah. Junior Mints. Are those okay? Yeah. The big thing is if it's something that you just bring to the movie theater and open in the theater kind of thing, then yeah. Go ahead and bring it. Just don't bring
a large bag of chips.
Yeah. Try it. Probably not. If that's personal for you, it's personal for me. I could eat a large bag of chips. So maybe something like that. Okay. So no popcorn. Also no alcohol. Alcohol is not allowed in the theater. So, if you do bring alcohol, you're going to have to do some parking lot alcohol or something like that. The plan is around, I keep changing this. I'm going to have like a whiteboard out front. In the lobby that kind of gives the schedule. Right now, the schedule is kind of roughly like 10:30 or 11 or so. We're going to watch Vertigo. And around 2 o'clock or so, we're watching Clue. And about 5 o'clock or so, we're watching The Fugitive. And we can't like have a meal in the theater. So I'm thinking probably sometime after Vertigo, we run out, get some Little Caesars pizzas down the street, consume those, you know, outside at the gazebo. It's going to be a beautiful day. Not too cold, I'm sure. Probably not below 95 degrees that day. and so, yeah, we'll do some of that. And, okay, I'm getting some raffle tickets ready. So it's those tickets that when you walk in, you can take a ticket and you can put the ticket in a bucket, and maybe we'll have some raffles at the end of the night.
Yeah. We also laid down some sweet hot cash for the parking lot.
Yes. Oh, yes. So you can park just in the back of the theater. Yeah, it's kind of the obvious theater parking lot. You can just park there.
So a couple of things that I think I'll prepare. One is because we expect to have a lot of previous guests there.
We hope.
And those guests can participate, especially in the awards part. So I'll probably print up some sheets with the awards, and people can take notes while they're watching the movie. Something like that might be helpful.
Then
also during Clue, we are trying to do kind of a Rocky Horror Picture Show thing in Clue, because there are many moments in the movie Clue where usually Wadsworth says something and the rest of the entire cast responds. And we're going to try and chime in with the rest of the cast. So maybe it'll work, and maybe it'll be one or two people yelling it out and everyone else wishing they'd shut up. So
it's going to be great, because we're going to be able to see Roy just exuberantly yell things out and then just get quieter and quieter as the movie goes on.
By the last one, it'll just be a whisper under my breath.
Yeah, you'll just be we'll just hear slight mutterings. It's going to be great, and it's going to put – it's going to put me in a great mood to podcast with you, Roy. Another thing I requested, they have like a little podium off to the side. And so that could be one of our microphones. Mm-hmm. And then we have another microphone at a table in front of the stage. And then we have another microphone that we can move around in the audience and put on a stand or whatever. So
awesome.
That should be plenty for people who want to speak. And if a lot of people want to speak at once, they can, they can take turns at the spare microphone that we have in the crowd. So
yeah, very good.
I think that's all about the big live event. Go ahead. If you're listening to this, then you know who I am. Go ahead and ask me anything. And if you don't know who I am and you're listening to this and you're planning on coming, or even if you're not planning on coming, just reiterate our email, which is yoursminetheirspodcast@gmail.com, which Roy will then forward to me, because I do not have the password to that email.
So, I don't either. As soon as I get signed out, we're in real trouble. So,
Bring your laptop. Make sure the email is working. Sure. If it's not, then find us on Facebook or leave a comment on the blog or whatever, and we'll find it. So, okay, that's it for next week. Oh, and if you haven't heard, we're watching – oh, I already said this – Vertigo, Clue, and The Fugitive, because we're resurrecting the detective category. So be thinking of who the best detective is of these movies. Come prepared to participate and contribute to the awards and the podcast once we start recording after all the movies are over. So that's it. That's next week. That's next week. That's in a week. I can't believe it. So by the time you listen to this, you're going to have to book your flight. You're going to have to make arrangements. You're going to have to get off work, because it's going to be Sunday or Monday before you hear about this. So hear now and make decisions later. Ask for forgiveness at work. Just come along. We'll see you there.
Yeah. We're going to see Richard there.
Yes. Yay. Richard, you're still planning on it, right?
Ooh, absolutely.
Are you going to bring Crystal?
I'll try.
Cool. Yeah, I'm. If you don't bring Crystal, tell Crystal I'm a fan. I think
delightful.
She's a really great part of your Star Trek podcast, and that's how I know.
I will let her know. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Tell her that the fourth most popular movie podcast is a fan of her contribution to your Star Trek podcast.
It's great to hear her do Star Trek for the first time. It takes us back, because Roy, you were Crystal about 13 years ago.
I was called Crystal back then.
Yeah, you were called Crystal, and you were watching Star Trek for the first time, and it's fun. So it's anyway, good job with that. Speaking of, if I may diverge, Richard, when are you going to start up your TV podcast again?
Anytime really? You want to come on that, yeah.
Okay. Well,
Richard and I are currently negotiating. So
really, you guys are negotiating. Richard, you might have to, if anybody else is planning a MASH episode, I doubt anybody else is, but MASH would probably be my show.
I'll take it, yeah.
All right, cool.
All right, then. Okay, sweet. Because there's zero relent in this podcast, 2 weeks from today, we are also podcasting. I have no idea. Well, I guess there's not much of a burden with the live podcast, because we're just doing it all live, right? There's no prep there. Maybe. But we are watching 21st century musical movies again with Richard. And the fans have chosen Moulin Rouge, which just barely qualifies. It was made in 2001. So I'm just looking forward to hearing Ewan McGregor yell, "She does, I love you." And then whatever else happens in that movie is fine, too. So we got to pick two more movies. Richard, you get to pick one. And we're going to try this time because we want to make the idea is to make this podcast longer and longer every time. So, Richard, I'm going to guess what musical you're going to pick, and John will guess as well. I'm going to go with Tick, Tick, Boom. I haven't seen it. It looks fascinating, and I think it's real life-ish about someone trying to produce a musical on Broadway, and that seems like that might be of interest to yourself. So, John, what do you think?
I'm looking for the poll. Where does it say it? Anything but Oh Brother, Where Art Thou is my pick. But specifically Chicago, maybe.
So your guess for Richard is Chicago?
Yeah, we'll go with Chicago.
Okay. All right. Well, Richard, what are you picking?
So this is a bit controversial. Yes, Tick, Tick, Boom is an amazing movie musical from the recent history, but I'm going to have to go with Dear Evan Hansen, even though there's a lot of controversy there. I'm just going to pick
people
it.
Really don't like that movie, Richard.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. Yeah. Sorry.
Oh, okay. No, I just assumed I'd never watch Dear Evan Hansen, but now you've given me the opportunity. So for that, I thank you. I never saw that's a play I've never seen, but I mean, I know it's quite beloved right now.
So my kids know the music and they like the music. I know the movie got fairly poor reviews, but like you, I'm looking forward to it. So it'll be good. All right. Yeah. What would you assume I'm going to pick, John?
Gosh, so many. Oh man, I can't believe not. Okay, sorry, I have to vote in this. Oh, I can't vote.
Did it close it out?
I think it closed it out. Well, I would have voted for La La Land because no one voted for La La Land.
That's kind of crazy.
Okay, I'm going to just take a big risk here. I'm going to say Mamma Mia.
You think I would have picked Mamma Mia?
I said it was a huge risk. Huge risk.
Okay. All right. Richard, what do you think?
I thought maybe Chicago.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So can we talk about Les Mis real quick? Let's just talk about it real quick.
Okay, no. Let's talk about it. I almost picked Les Mis.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Because, like, I love it. I really, really, really love it, right? Mm-hmm. And it's got some huge flaws, like, what's his head? Russell Crowe. He's just really awful in that movie. And there's some extreme close-up issues. But there's really great things about this movie.
So your pick is The Muppets.
Anne Hathaway, right? Like, her performance. Like, has anyone, like, spent less time on screen and won an Academy Award? But I would say also that the big revelation in this movie to me was Eddie Redmayne, right?
Uh-huh.
Like, he's incredible. And Empty Chairs at Empty Tables might be the song of the movie for me. And also, I cry at the end. So there you go. Now that we've had the discussion, I'm going to pick Across the Universe. So there you go.
Are you really picking Across the Universe?
I'm really picking Across the Universe.
Okay. Let's talk about Les Miserables more then.
Okay.
Because, I mean, and you said the close-up thing. It's a huge missed opportunity for Les Miserables is in the big scene that's like supposed to be so powerful is the Fantine scene, I Dreamed a Dream. And it's – and I kind of think it's really – it's supposed to be really like, I don't know, dramatic and cruel and gritty and, you know, considering the circumstances of what's happening during that scene. But I kind of think it's just kind of atrocious, you know?
Oh, I love that scene. I think I love that scene.
But well, the thing is, if you're going to make a movie musical, I mean, musicals that are meant to be on the stage, but if you're going to be cinematic about it, you may as well take the opportunity cinematically because that song, I Dreamed a Dream, it actually has a flashback sequence within it.
Oh.
And so you may as well film that. I think it was because that's something you can't do on stage. So you may as well do it in film rather than just doing the close-up of Fantine. So I think missed opportunity there. But and I will definitely say like the stuff with Fantine is great. And Anne Hathaway, I love her and she's great. But
the second half of Les Miserables, I think, is so much stronger than the first half.
I've always thought that.
Yeah.
So I agree with that very, very wholeheartedly. I will also say, like, something that just, like, drove me crazy at the movie theater was, like, this movie's all about the music. And I thought it was just the theater I went to, but the sound mixing or something, right? Mm-hmm. Like, the sound should have been, like, booming all around me. And it felt like they mixed it so that it, like, was coming from a small speaker at the front of the screen. And it wasn't just where I saw it at the movie theater. Like, when I watch it at home, it just feels like the sound mixing is very poor.
Because they actually recorded it live, which is unusual for musicals, which was, like, novel at the time. I don't think it really caught on very well. You know, because mostly, you know, when you film a musical, you actually record the entire soundtrack and then you lip sync the songs. That's how you make musicals, because that's the way you're able to cut around and make cuts and edits, because you can't make cuts and edits if you're taken from different audio source material with every cut, right? So, but they actually changed that for Les Miserables.
Yeah.
And they actually, like, had microphones that they wore that they digitally removed, and I don't think it worked.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The sound was less than fulfilling. I don't know. So, all that being the case, Les Miserables has been remade multiple times. And that's a category that could be voted on at
Les Miserables?
Yes, Les Miserables.
Yeah.
So, you know, if that category ever got chosen, then you could do The Stars Are Born, Les Miserables, right? There's a couple of those. Anyway, we're doing Across the Universe because it's a musical and it's about the Beatles. And I really, really love the Beatles, and I love musicals, so that's what we're doing.
Awesome. You know, I don't know. You never even saw A Hard Day's Night before you were forced to watch it on this podcast, so I don't even know how much of a fan you can call yourself.
So have you guys seen Across the Universe?
I have not.
Yeah, in the theater.
I thought you hadn't, John. You've seen it, though, Richard?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's lovely. Was it Joel Edgerton? Is that the guy?
I think so.
And then who's the lady? She's a semi-famous lady. I can't remember her name. Is it Evan Rachel Wood?
Oh, that sounds right.
I think you're right.
Yeah.
Well,
we should have IMDb open all the time, but we don't.
I know, right?
No, I do have it open all the time. I just have to type in the name of the dumb.
All right, get to typing.
Evan Rachel Wood. Yeah, that's right.
Yep. Okay. Across the Universe. Got it. Yep.
I don't know if I appreciate the name Evan for a girl.
All right. Anyway, I'm sure to thoroughly enjoy it, and we'll see what you guys think. Anyway, that's what's coming up in 2 weeks. We'll have a good time. So go out, watch those three movies, or don't, but just listen to the podcast anyway, and, you know, we'll talk about them. After that, there's no category vote for movies on this time, because Ammon's just going to come back on and make us watch movies that he's never seen. However, we have found ourselves in a Losers Club situation, because you guys didn't want to watch movies where Sean Bean dies. For the third time, you didn't want to watch movies where Sean Bean dies. So now, when Ammon comes on, his second film podcast with us is going to involve either 50s musicals, movies about a person who goes into the wilderness alone, or movies where Sean Bean dies. One of these three-time losers is finally going to get it shot. And Ammon will have to deal with that.
I wonder how Ammon will deal with that. I wonder where Ammon, because, you know, Ammon is the, you know, he cast the deciding vote in the Senate just in case there's a tie, right?
Yeah.
So
yes, he does. That is true.
Yeah. I wonder how he'll wield his power, because I don't really see any of those for Ammon, really. I bet he'd go with musicals again. That'd be interesting.
That would be that would be like 3 out of 4 podcasts in a row where we'd be watching heavy music movies. So
it would have been 3 out of 3 if we didn't disrupt it with this live event. It's not even a part
live
of things.
Event.
Yeah.
Just, by the way, I do want to say I really wanted to watch West Side Story. I really wanted to watch In the Heights. And now I guess I'm glad I didn't pick In the Heights, because John can't watch more than 5 minutes of it.
Can't do it.
Do it. So that would have been a short podcast.
Yeah.
So I think that is all we have.
Wow.
Richard, thank you so much for coming on, and thank you for bringing these delightful Judy Garland movies. I'm so glad I got to watch them. I hadn't seen any of them before, and now my wife asked if I'm obsessed with Judy Garland. I don't know. I am enjoying my education of Judy. Thank you, sir.
Yeah, it was a great run. Great picks, Richard. You know, thanks for I mean, it was inventive for us. We wouldn't have done it unless you brought it along. So we can do nothing else but thank you, and I had a great time.
I appreciate it. Thank you for having me. Happy 100th birthday to Judy Garland.
That's
in
right.
Heaven. Yeah.
Wow. When is that?
It was June 10th.
Oh, wow. Perfect. Okay. Yeah. So this is her big celebration. Judy, if you're up there, I hope we did it right. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, Richard, we will see you in 7 days, and then we will podcast again in 2 weeks, sir.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Everybody out there, we'll see you live. That's when next we see you. So see you in person. In the meantime, see you online.
Yeah, I put in a stupid title, and once in a blue moon, you use it. And then I tell my wife, who high-fives me.
I don't think she knows that you podcast.